Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60. And I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. Right, I believe, I think this means we are live. You don't need to know what's going on in the background right now. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell. I'm real good at doing the podcast hosting. But, you know, I tend to go by Some Gadget Guy across social media, and that's the SGG of this terribly named podcast. But the QA is the important part that obviously stands for question and answer. We like to make this an interactive conversation, kind of sort out our feelings on the week of tech news. That's why I like to host my podcast on a Monday, a little time to sort of sort out what's going on. Maybe some news broke this morning, and the whole world of AI is in utter calamity. And this is going to be kind of an interesting show. I actually woke up this morning and was like, hey, I don't even know if I can host like a proper format show. Maybe I'll just make it a pajama podcast or something like that. But there are some news blog stories I really want us to cover. And I also wanted to use this as an opportunity. Like, for example, on my YouTube channel, videos recently have been just getting hammered if they're not just like singularly most popular Apple Samsung content. I'm just getting wrecked. And I'm trying to diversify. I want to talk about mini PCs, and I want to talk about health tech. I'm planning an entire like reformat of all of my old playlists and stuff. And I posted an interview with the MediaTek executives from MediaTek Summit, and I'd like to use the podcast here to kind of share some of that information, because with so much AI conversation happening, there is a significant amount of resource. There are significant resources being put on your phone towards facilitating this new AI future. And I think the MediaTek executives had some interesting things to say about that. So there's going to be a little gap in the middle where we play, you know, the interview, and I'll still be in the chat. It's not like I'm going to just go on autopilot or something like that. But I want us to kind of flesh out this conversation, and especially in the chat, I'd love to hear what folks have to say, and we can come back and kind of share where I feel like the commentary is still a little bit lacking on what our phones are going to be doing with the artificial intelligence, basically generative AI and language learning models. So I'm already seeing an incredible group in this chat right now. GoatV8, JMan150, Simon Says Hypno, Ghost Starscream, already having done the Canadian Thanksgiving. Awesome Possum, Vince Navoa, Fat Produce. Fat Produce, I believe, is hyping up his Steam Deck OLED purchase. Barry Johnson will be lurking for 30 minutes. I hope everyone is doing well today. I doing quite well, Barry. Hope you're doing well too. Bryant Billing, Brian Glaze, Ron Guido, Coppa Cash. I know I'm missing some folks in here. I'm sorry about that. I'm trying to keep up with the chat while we're doing it. No, Simon Says Hypno. See, this is what I like. Simon Says Hypno, Finbar likes to get his answers in before a question is finished. The bloody Irish. I like an executive who's candid, and you can kind of put him on the spot. Because then he started doing that, where he was sort of falling into some of the main talking points on Dimensity 9300. And then I was able to kind of step on that a little bit. And that, to me, was a much more engaged conversation than just, that's a great question. I'm glad, you know, I hate it when there are those big old gaps, and like you've got to sort of, I don't know, put pieces together. You've got to like trim stuff down. Finbar is one of my favorite conversations whenever we get to do this media tech stuff. I was really happy I got to do the interview with him. All right. But that's for later. We've got, I do want to tackle just a little bit of housekeeping. And first of all, I hope everybody had a lovely weekend. You might have noticed that both TK and I were at the MediaTek event. They call it the Executive Summit. They bring in a little bit of media and some influencers and stuff just to kind of talk about what the next year for MediaTek is going to look like. This year was a little funky. Often MediaTek is one of the first to start talking about what they're going to do for the next year. But this year, you know, we had Apple really pushing out messaging on M Silicon and A17 Pro. We had Qualcomm really lead into the conversation. To me, it felt like Qualcomm was really on the defensive this year, where, you know, oh, we're going to put out everything that we know about Snapdragon 8 Gen 3, and influencers are in Maui. Oh, isn't that great? And MediaTek actually kind of was coming in late this year for some of their conversation on the silicon industry. And I think they've got some really interesting things to talk about in terms of smartphone performance. I'm very anxious about chips in our phones for next year, for how good the Dimensity 9200 and the Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 have been. We're starting to get those early indications that chips next year are going to be crazy powerful, but that they might not be as power efficient. And that, I think, is something we've been concerned about for a couple years in Android land. Actually, and something that iPhone owners, I think, are starting to kind of feel a little bit too. Like, my phone is supposedly so powerful, but what can I really do with it? And then when I really try to stress it, maybe I don't like that battery life. Maybe I don't like how hot the back of the phone gets. Maybe I only get like 20 frames per second in Resident Evil on my brand spanking new iPhone that is supposed to be the most powerful thing ever, but has very poor cooling hardware to maintain, you know, consistent frame rates in a really beefy game. Maybe that's not what consumers are looking for in a phone. Okay, so let's jump in on a little housekeeping. I actually got some stuff out. It's so tricky balancing like podcasting and videos and trying to put together commentary. And then when you're also boots on the ground, because it's like I'm all by myself. So if I get anything out, it's like, oh, I just finished this media event. I got to hang out with some of my friends. And now I got to go back to my hotel room and edit and write. So I was happy to get some stuff out. Here, let me go into a screen share real quick. On the Patreon, I'm really excited about this video. I guarantee you that... Oh, whoops. I'm messing up my OBS. I'm doing real bad at the streaming right now. I just completely reorganized my order of video elements in OBS because I'm trying to do that interview today. Take a breath. Screen sharing my web browser. I'm really excited about this video that's in early access. It'll be going public in a couple of days, and it'll be available first on the Patreon. The laziest, maybe dumbest upgrade for Manas. Let's fix my Plex. And I'm holding something in my hand there that's just a little bit of a clue as to what that upgrade might be. But this is the kind of stuff that I'd like to start branching out even a bit more aggressively. I enjoy doing new phone after new phone after new phone, but this last year was burnout. This last year was like, man, I got three different Vivos that were all kind of the same. I got a handful of Xiaomi that weren't really that different. I'm really enjoying my time with the Pixel Fold, and then it was whiplash right back into Pixel 8 Pro. I haven't finished my Pixel Fold camera review, and I'm immediately sort of like, well, I got to start shooting samples on the Pixel 8 Pro, and I feel like I've got to stop putting together the comprehensive videos. It really, I really need to, it's like, I got this new phone, this is one feature on it, that's like a 3-minute video. Thank you. Smash that bell icon and move on. Because I keep stacking the comprehensive content, and now I'm like backlogged for months. I'm backlogged on finishing like what will end up being 20 to 40 minute videos. But we're also like into the end of the year, so who's gonna watch, you know, like the full real review on a phone that launched like 3 or 4 months ago. So, I I'm trying to find some other feature pieces and things to do beyond just, here is a mini PC and it has these specs, and then I played a game on it, and isn't that neat? And so one of the things that our family is struggling with right now is some of our media streaming capability, and maybe there's a really lazy way to improve that. There's a correct way to do that. Like, maybe I need to buy a better NAS or build a NAS or do something like that. But there's also a really lazy way to do that. Moving right along, and we'll talk about this a little bit too. Here, let me go back into my screen share. Also on the Patreon, just some very, very lean first impressions. There was a Vivo X100 Pro floating around the MediaTek Summit with that brand new Dimensity 9300 that I couldn't really do any testing or benchmarking on. But, you know, a bunch of us nerds were hanging out, taking photos of the phone, kind of playing around with some of the camera stuff. Really interesting ideas on display, and we can talk about that a little later in the podcast. And then another major video that I put out last week. I'm a big fan of tinkering with my brain, and the folks at Apollo Neuroscience have this wearable with a giant haptic motor in it that is supposed to deliver vibration to your nervous system to help stimulate and to help guide your mood. So this isn't like a mental health wearable, but it's a touch therapy wearable. And I got to spend some time with that. And I've got some really, I've got some complicated thoughts. Like, I got to the end of this video. They sponsored the video for me to talk about it. And I still was like, first of all, I don't call sponsored videos reviews, but there is no way I could come to a conclusion or a review conclusion on this kind of product. I'm a sample size of one, and I also can't compare my mood to what it would have been had I not been wearing the wearable in that moment. The holidays are a really stressful time. I hope you're taking care of yourselves. I hope you're getting good rest. I hope you're planning those outings, you know, see some family, see some friends, eat some great food. But we get to the end of the year, and we put this end of the year pressure on ourselves. And this was kind of the right time just to try. This is something that's supposed to help calm you in the evenings and help energize you in the mornings. And it's built on a technology that I thought was rad. If anyone remembers, while I was at Pocket Now, we were at CES and we found this little mini booth in their CES like experience zone, where it's just tiny little kiosks of people presenting for CES. And I found this company, Lowfelt, and they made a product called the Baselet. Like bracelet, but with bass. And basically, it was a wearable subwoofer. And it had this giant haptic motor, super detailed haptic motor that would just sort of vibrate into your body to simulate the effect of standing in front of a subwoofer. And people made fun of me of it because I thought it was rad. This is super cool technology. But it was like, oh, but it, you know, smartwatch needs to be a fitness tracker, and it needs to have a screen, needs to do all these other things. And like, I feel like we're missing the opportunity to talk about single-purpose wearable gadgets, because this one had a profound impact on listening to music. If you care about listening to music, and you get into those audiophile geek debates about, well, but the rumble and the sub bass and blah, 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 and you're wearing headphones, you do not know what that feels like until you can incorporate the concussive force of standing in front of a subwoofer, and that augments the music listening experience. That's the company that's making the haptics for this Apollo Neuro wearable. So I got real lit up about that. I really liked what Lowfelt was doing, and their sort of science team is kind of incredible. So I think that covers me for... and then, of course, the MediaTek interview that we'll be playing here later on in this podcast right now. So some interesting things to talk about and just kind of getting to the end of the year where I'm trying to find fun conversations that aren't just, hey, Black Friday, you should click on all of my affiliate links and you should buy. Because I don't know about y'all, is this starting to feel like one of those holiday seasons where, I mean, sure, I know a lot of folks save up to get their holiday shopping done on good sales, but after 2 years of pandemic, all of us were overbuying tech at home and work from home and new phones and new tablets. And if you were in the United States, there were a couple of those stimulus checks. And I think that really bumped up iPhone sales. Is this feeling like a Christmas where maybe people are buying experiences instead? I'm talking to my siblings and I'm talking to my parents. And I mean, I mean, there are some things that, you know, like, oh, it would be really nice if I could have this, or like a nice sweater, or, you know, something like that. But it's like a, I need clothes to go outside again, not I need a new phone case for my phone. Like, no one gifts that in my family, and I don't know what it's like in your family. Do people give you phone cases? That's such a, like, a personal purchase to me. It would be nice, but I would never use a case that someone else just sent me. And one of the major things is, like, oh, well, maybe we could put some money towards a nice meal. Like, you know, my brother and his wife, they just had their first child, and if we could cover the cost of a really nice evening out, you know, I think that would be like a memory moment, you know, not just, oh, hey, brother, I got you these earbuds, and, you know, maybe you like them, maybe you don't. I have a hard time with sort of the granular nuance of all the tech that I use, really sitting down and saying, like, well, I think they would like it, but I want them to try it, and they could. And so maybe they would appreciate this type of audio. And so I just get way up into my own head when it comes to gift giving like that. Ghost Starscream, I'm tempted on getting the Aura Ring, but the monthly required sub is holding me back. Yeah, the folks at Apollo Neuroscience got a lot of data from Aura Ring when they were doing their own studies, like trying to follow trends on people's health. Aura Ring was one of their primary resources in kind of collecting that data. Simon says, Hypno, I splurged this week. Good for you. I mean, because I'm talking about gift giving from other people. Well, you're talking about treat yourself. You go treat yourself, son. Like, Pixel Fold, amazing sale. If you really wanted to kind of dabble with the foldable and like, it's only a little bit more expensive than the most expensive Slate phones out there, like, it's not a bad buy. You could have a lot of fun with that. Bryant Billing, and buying less in general. I kind of feel a lot of my family and friends. If anything, we're trying to look at responsible ways of gifting, donating, and selling some of the stuff that we already have. And that's kind of tough. You know, I have a lot of liberal guilt over, you know, I've got an office full of tech. And, you know, I've tried to do things like, well, maybe if I set up some giveaways, but I can't really ship internationally and the taxes kind of wreck you and it's not really fair. And someone with, like, no relationship to your channel is just hovering and waiting to see contests and giveaways go live. And it's really scummy if you're doing things like doing giveaways on Patreon. You can pay me for a chance to win some of my used gear. Just is kind of vomitous. Like, I really don't like that idea. So we same, Brian, not just buying less in general, but really trying to cater to experiences and finding ways to kind of responsibly let go of some of this stuff. Ghost Starscream, the fun of being an introvert. I never received gifts or give gifts. Well, buddy, if we can just give you the gift of friendship on this stream, Ghost Starscream, I know you're very loud and cantankerous in my YouTube comments, and I love you for it. So happy holidays from some Gadget Guys podcast. My gift to you. I'm sorry, that's terrible. Yeah, Gary the Fireman, good lightning deals on Amazon right now. I'm not saying don't go buy stuff. If you were planning on buying stuff, shop the sales. We always categorize things. I refuse to look at, like, sale price versus full price. I always categorize by MSRP, but I also have to acknowledge, like, you really shouldn't be buying stuff full MSRP, right? Like, we know the prices and sales on these things fluctuate like crazy. Oh, Brian, my wife and I were just talking about this. Inflation is hitting budgets hard this year. I'm to the point I'm looking for a new job. Journalism is barely paying the bills. I'm sorry to hear that. I hope you and your family are doing well. My wife and I, we both work, so we're bringing in dual income. And she just went to Target and was like, man, the stuff that we used to get, there's like another 30% price hike on some of the food that we buy and some of the things that we were looking to shop and like some of the gifts that we were planning on giving. And I really am getting frustrated with this commentary like, oh, the economy is actually starting to turn around and look at this, everything's in great shape. And you're like, no, it's really not. If you call the economy how rich people make money on stocks, yeah, they're doing fine. But if you call the economy how everybody survives and puts a roof over their head and eats food, then no, we're doing quite poorly right now. Not been great. Not been great at all. Simon says, no, they already got their gifts. Phones. Simon says, Hypno, hey Juan, send J-Man a water bottle. I really need to do better on the merch. Like, maybe I need to set up, I don't know. I'm so bad at doing the designs, but actually, like, maybe I could do like a Megapickle water bottle or something like that. That'd be kind of fun. That'd be pretty sweet. Oh, go Starscream! Turning 23 tomorrow. Nobody likes you when you're 23. Happy birthday, and I hope you get to do something fun. Again, even if you don't feel like you've got the ability to reach out to people or invite them to go do something, just go do something for yourself. Go do something silly. Go to a fancy restaurant by yourself or go catch a movie by yourself. Just, like, treat yourself. Take yourself out on a date, and I think it'll do wonders for your headspace. It'll be something fun. You know, make your own memory. Oh, Fat Produce, I'm wearing my Save the Jack t-shirt today. Woo-hoo! I'm wearing my Bokeh hoodie. I just yelled into the microphone. Sorry about that, folks. I pulled up the hoodie so that I could talk even louder into the microphone that's on my hoodie. But I need to get way better about putting that stuff together. And see, and the thing is, like, I design stuff for, like, my family. Like, I made a queen-themed coffee mug for my aunt for Christmas this year. And, like, okay, I can put that together. I can really do it. I can get it through, you know, like, one of the companies that I use to, like, print the merch on my mugs and t-shirts. Why can't I just do that for my channel? And the second I sit down and I try to think about, like, what should some gadget guy merch look like, I immediately blank. Like, all these ideas that I come up with for other people, I sit down and I try to do the same for myself. And there is no muse and there is no inspiration. And it kills me. I'm real bad at it. Oh, we've got, this one's kind of fun. Okay. Fat Produce is gifting a tier one sub to Muppinish. Thank you so much, Andrew, for supporting the live stream on Twitch and for contributing and bringing people in and hooking people. And Muppinish, I'm glad to see you on the stream, and thanks for supporting the show. This Fanfare of Glory, as courtesy of one Mr. Barry Johnson, is for you. Ta-da! All right. That was a rambling exercise in housekeeping and not doing it well. I'm going to take a drink of coffee. Let's switch gears. Talk a little bit about some tech because we've got a lot of, like, meltdown conversations this week. Like, the world of social media and AI is in turmoil right now. And I'm kind of curious to get your thoughts on what's happening with Twitter and OpenAI. So let me take a sip here real quick. We'll jump right in. All right. So, I don't know about y'all. I am significantly scaling back on my interactions with Twitter. It's kind of killing me because a lot of my business relationships and even things like when I do sponsored content, they still primarily focus on Twitter, even though Twitter engagement has cratered. If you're not paying Twitter a lot of money, your content isn't really being promoted or discovered on Twitter. I can kind of verify this anecdotally with a sample size of one. This is not a comprehensive study. But I regularly will post similar things across Threads and Blue Sky and Mastodon and Twitter. And I have the most followers on Twitter and I'm getting the least engagement or the least reaction to the stuff that I post. So the solution would be to pay Twitter just so that the people who are already following me on Twitter will start to see my stuff again. And I philosophically can't do that. I know other people are going to have different criteria for what they are comfortable doing, but seeing is how the money that Twitter is generating, while Twitter's in the red, Twitter's not making money, they are drastically losing money, and their valuation has basically been cut in half since when Elon Musk bought them for $40 billion. Twitter was never worth $40 billion. Elon Musk is bad at the business. We're seeing more and more of that money go into these schemes. I'm still shocked that there hasn't been a regulatory investigation of Twitter where if you pay Twitter, you have a chance for your content to receive ad money back. I'm going to repeat that because I said it very clumsily. If you pay Twitter for your little checkmark, then you go into a bucket of content creators. And if your content is popular on Twitter, then you can receive money back from Twitter's advertising. On its face, that sounds pretty good. Twitter's doing some kind of profit share. You know, advertising is posted on Twitter, and then Twitter's giving you a cut of what comes back. But it's a fund that Twitter manages. And Twitter decides what's popular. So Twitter holds the keys to what content is going to become visible on their site. You pay Twitter for a chance of convincing Twitter that they should monetize your traffic, and then it's up to Twitter to decide whether or not they're going to do that. And that makes it even worse when we see the kinds of posters, and we see the kind of participants that Twitter is popularizing on their platform. At this point, I mean, I know the attack or the slight has lost a lot of its meaning, but they're so far deep into the alt-right and posting, you know, fascist-style material, white supremacist material, and some really ugly misogynistic and racist content, bigoted content. At some point, people and my fellow tech brethren, you're like, I don't believe any of them. Any of my friends who are still regularly interacting on Twitter are awful people, but they seem to be fine subsidizing the pockets of awful people. And I don't know what else to sort of do to express that. You know, we can all say, like, ironically, we're sitting here watching Twitter burn, but you're really still just using Twitter, giving them traffic, giving them momentum, and popularizing content from very hateful individuals. At some point, you pull that back. At some point, you say, no, I'm not okay with that, and I'm going to start posting my content somewhere else, even if it means I personally have to rebuild part of my audience on another platform. You know, it's kind of like the jokes that we would say often about, like, the Trump MAGA style Republicans. Like, you know, they're probably not Nazis, but they've decided that they're fine supporting Nazis, right? It's kind of becoming a similar and untenable situation on Twitter. So this last week, we got into another kerfluffle. And I still don't understand this sort of weak approach from other major corporations that are saying, like, oh, you put our company's ads next to really hateful content. We're going to pause advertising on your platform till you straighten out. Till you straighten up, sir. Till you do better. You can't shame Elon Musk into doing better. Twitter is never going to get better. It might sustain, or there might be a small corrective action, but everything about Twitter's current trajectory has been burning Twitter to the ground. And that's going to continue. You know, it's kind of like when climate science deniers are like, oh, but this year there was no climate change. And you see, like, a graph over 20 years of how hot the Earth has been getting. But for 1 year, it peaked at the beginning of the year and then dropped a little in the middle of the year. And they're like, see, that was totally flat. If I only look at this three-month period of time, it you know, climate science is full of hooey. And then you look next year and it's like, oh, this is, again, the hottest year on record. Ha ha. It's kind of like that with Twitter, but with fascists. Oh, IBM and Apple got real pissy with Elon Musk, and for 3 months, they sort of tried to do a better job of reining in hate speech, but we know it's going to get worse, and it's going to continue to get worse because of the stance that Elon Musk himself has taken on popularizing really hateful content. So... I'm sorry, I got way behind on the chat here. Yeah, Dr. Claude, Twitter is deep into its impoopification process. It is just now legit straight poop. It's not even like on the way to. It is awful. And I don't know how to reach people and say like, this sucks. I know you have audience. But especially for some of my tech pals, like, okay, so you have a couple thousand followers on Twitter. You're paying Twitter just to reach a fraction of them. Go somewhere else and rebuild. Put it in your YouTube videos and rebuild. It sucks. It does. I'm doing it right now. It sucks. But I'm already getting more engagement for free on every other platform that I'm earnestly participating on. And especially for me, that's Mastodon. I have like 700 followers on Mastodon. I've got 16,000 followers on Twitter. Which place gets me more traffic, more engagement, and more real human connection? Because it ain't Twitter. Okay, so sorry, I was actually going to pull up this story here from Axios. The reason why I'm pulling this up is I usually don't like linking these hyper-abbreviated chronologies of what's going on, but this one has gotten so like spiky and kind of ugly. This is Sarah Fisher over at Axios Media. Let me pull this up here. I think they've done a really good job of sort of summarizing the ins and outs and just how gross this whole thing has sort of become. Here, hold on one second. Okay, so a slew of marquee advertisers suspended their advertising on X, formerly Twitter, Friday in a response to a post by Elon Musk that endorsed an anti-Semitic post on Wednesday. Why it matters. This is the closest X has come to a large-scale boycott since Musk purchased the platform more than a year ago. So I really want to clarify that. They're saying large scale. What they mean are the companies that spend the most money advertising. Because we've seen consistent drops in advertising revenue. They are not rebounding. Like, they keep claiming they're about to start making more money back from ads. That hasn't happened. That's all been a lie. Literally nothing that I've seen come out of Twitter, especially in terms of PR, has ever been earnest conversation. And we know for months that they would just reply to media inquiries with a poop emoji. These are not serious people. These are not earnest participants. They are unreliable narrators. Literally no information we get out of this company can be taken just at its face value. And if it weren't for the work, the Herculean work of third-party entities auditing what happens on Twitter, with increasing barriers from Twitter to get access to this data, we would have no idea just how bad all of this has gotten. Sorry, back to the Axios post. Apple and IBM, two of X's biggest tech advertisers, both said they would pause advertising on X. Lionsgate, Disney, Comcast, NBC, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Discovery, and other firms also paused their marketing. The left-leaning nonprofit Media Matters for America published a report Thursday that highlighted Apple, IBM, Amazon, and Oracle as among those whose ads were shown next to far-right posts. This is from Ruben Shears at Media Ubiquity, media and analysis firm. It's not just advertising adjacent to this kind of horrendous content. It's also the creator program that Musk has rolled out. X's creator program shares ad revenue with certain users that have a certain reach. Advertisers have grown wary of their ad dollars, maybe funding creators who post questionable content. Immediately, when I started describing how brutal this pyramid, someone help me here, because it's not a pyramid scheme, it's like a payola, it's like a pay-to-play. There's a specific word that we use when you have to give a company money for a chance to earn money back. And I don't know what phrase we use to describe that. In smaller forms, it's kind of like, not like MLM. That's kind of a little like an MLM. But, you know, everyone my age would get this, like, offer to, you know, meet for a job interview. And you'd go there and it'd be like, Cutco Knives! And you're like, oh my God, I got to get out of here. A few friends always seem to get roped into something like, oh, you give us tons and tons of money, and then you're at the beginning of this conversation, and you get to hire other people, and you get to be your own business owner selling these knives. And isn't that so? Look, these knives can cut through a tin can. It's a little like that, but worse, because you're also dealing with complete and total black box analysis from Twitter. Like, they're not going to give you data on how well you're performing or what would help improve. Even YouTube does a miserable job of actually guiding creator content. If you just go to YouTube, I mean, if I could show you this without getting a content strike on my channel, if I go to YouTube and just say, like, well, okay, give me some ideas, topics, trending topics, give me keywords, stuff like that. Basically, I know I'm just going to get, well, if you make tech videos, talk about Samsung and Apple. And that's it. If I go there now, that's all I'm going to get from YouTube is, well, what's already the most popular? And you can do that for your audience. And then we'll send your videos to your audience, because we won't send your videos to your audience unless we see that you're only talking about the most popular stuff. But now, that would be like if I were paying YouTube to do that kind of consulting and still not getting any benefit for my money. It's pretty brutal. So I don't want to completely read through everything here on this Axios post. Please check it out if you've been kind of curious, like, why this one seems like it's a little bit different. I am very disappointed in all of these major companies. I'm so tired of Apple promoting this idea of, you know, oh, we're the soft, fluffy, feel good, think different company. And, oh, we don't tolerate bullying. Bullying is never a part of our company's culture. I'm Tim Cook, and I testified before a House Judicial Committee under oath to say that we would never bully, and bullying is just not allowed. And we take a firm stance on this type of ethics for our company, but we're fine dumping tons of money into Twitter. And Twitter's violating so many of our App Store guidelines and policies and content moderation. But, you know, we'll just give them another chance. One more chance, and you know, they'll get it right. I'm sure Elon Musk will really care about it this time, and that's really gonna, he said he's really earnest about participating this time. Oh, this is what's funny. Simon says, you kind of beat me to the punch on this. I am for freedom of speech without repercussion until it's about me and my money, and then I sue. That is exactly what Elon Musk is doing. Hold on. One more from the Axios. I want you to read the Axios, the piece here. I'm sorry. I know I'm kind of subverting it. Musk is still blaming researchers and political groups. He posted early Saturday that X will be filing a, quote, thermonuclear lawsuit against Media Matters and all those who colluded in this fraudulent attack on our company. He argued Media Matters report misrepresented the user experience on X. Again, nothing he says is reliable. If you go on, so from my side of this, I've not been getting hit with a lot of the really toxic aspects of Twitter. I'm not getting hit with the far, far right. The few that have kind of trampled on a few of my posts, especially when I bring up topics like net neutrality, I mute and move on. For a while, those muting tools were broken, and I was just getting dumped with everything that I had muted before. Those seem to have been corrected and fixed now. So when I mute someone, I don't see their stuff. And I don't really care. You want to engage with me, I'm never going to see it. But increasingly, I'm getting follower after follower after follower who are obvious bots. And so this whole shtick that Elon Musk was going to, like, save Twitter and revive Twitter and repair Twitter from all of the fake posting and bot accounts, Not only completely untrue, but has scaled up, ramped up, and gotten way worse since Musk has owned the company. There is so little earnest, there's so little honest interaction with people. And when I post something out there, I'm always down to chat about stuff. I'm getting very little back. So I know people really aren't seeing this stuff pop up in their feed. And it's the priority of highlighting blue check marks. So we're at a point now, like, if you're a journalist on Twitter, you got to look at leaving Twitter. I don't know what's really going to tip. Ponzi scheme. Yeah, payola and a Ponzi scheme. Thank you. So Wade County and Simon Says Hypno saying Ponzi. Ghost Starscream. Is it a pyramid, square, rectangle, triangle? Is it a circle? And Dr. Claw, this is hilarious too. Dr. Claw says, I used to see incessant ads from Apple on Twitter, especially after a new iPhone came out, but now it's just a bunch of snake oil stuff. And the quality of ads has plummeted too. I've been talking about this for a little while too, because I think it's funny. YouTube seems to use advertising as a way to harm the end user experience, to try and convince more people to sign up for ever more expensive subscriptions. I do not like using Meta services. I don't like using Facebook. I mean, I basically stopped using Facebook. I haven't logged in or to really look at anything on Facebook in years. I still occasionally post stuff to Instagram, but when I scroll through Instagram, now it's all miserable, short, wannabe TikTok videos and BS like that. But when ads scroll by, they occasionally catch my eye. I'll be scrolling through and like, oh, actually, wait a minute, hold on. That was kind of a cool little solar panel thing. Let me just check that out. The ads on Instagram are better tailored to make me stop scrolling and look at the ad than anything Google has done. My Google News feed is like half legit advertisements and half scams. Like, there are actual practical scams that are showing up in my Google News feed. I talked about one on the Discord. I scrolled through and it was someone selling Anker crate batteries. You know, those really, really big batteries like the 757, 767. Videos of both can be found on youtube.com/JuanBagnell at some gadget guy. And I was like, wait a minute. They're saying that they're going to sell these things for like hundreds of dollars when these are like $2,000 batteries. And I go to the website and it's this hack URL. And this is obviously a scam to get people's credit card info. And you're like, Google just put that up in my Google News feed. That is so irresponsible. That is such crap. But, you know, like, Instagram, of all places, will occasionally make me pause and go, oh, you know what? I kind of want to look that up. Well, let me just check it out. I'm not going to buy it through Instagram, but maybe I'll go and check it out on Amazon. Twitter, nothing has shown up in an ad that has made me consider for a second whether or not I want to do business with that company. And the second I see that something is an ad on Twitter, I think very poorly of the company that is advertising on Twitter.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Oh, man. McCorkran, Twitter is run worse than Reddit, which is saying something. At least you can read Reddit without an account or verifying your ID with a phone number. Now, I'd say let's not get too invested in Reddit anymore. I'm still sad that I had to shut down my subreddit. I'm not bringing it back until I see some sort of structural change over at Reddit. But what I see is an application of mangling user experiences that is just maybe a couple years behind Twitter. And that eventually we're going to see them shift towards more of these ridiculously bad Elon Musk type policies, because that seems to be a massive influence on the direction that Reddit is heading. I have not found a reasonable solution for replacing all of my Reddit usage. Right now, I kind of dabble with some of Lemmy, and it's not the same, and it's way more confusing than it needs to be. And I don't like how topics and channels are kind of replicated over different Lemmy instances. But if you want to start looking at something to kind of pull some of your Reddit time away from Reddit, Lemmy and Mastodon are kind of some of the best bets right now. And you are treated so much better, your content is respected so much more, and especially for us geeky folks, like the crowd of people over there that are talking about open source software and right to repair initiatives and cool things to do with your phone. The Android community is kind of hardcore over on Mastodon. I feel like you're missing out. If you're kind of tired of like how Reddit can sort of be bookends, like there are a lot of people on Reddit that are really solving those tech support questions, doing some really great like high level, you know, really cool techy stuff. And then there's just a swarm of people at like the lowest level. I don't know how to do power button on my phone. Can someone power button my phone, please help? And there's more of the nerdy stuff over on Lemmy. There's less to sift through than there is on Reddit. But it's not quite the same. You don't have quite the same influx of users, but really that only gets better if more people use Lemmy. More people use Lemmy, then stuff gets better. If more people keep using Reddit, oh, I'll just keep using it until it gets as terrible as Twitter, then, you know, you're not going to have an alternative when it does get as terrible as Twitter. And that, to me, is kind of a bummer. Hold on, let me scroll through here. I'm way behind on the chat, so I'm going to try and catch us up. Yeah, the ads are legitimately terrible over on Twitter. Oh, I know, a lot of people are saying, like, I just wish I could read Twitter without having a Twitter account. What is the alternative front end? I mean, there are actually kind of a couple, but I think Knitter, N-I-T-T-E-R, is that right? That sounds like I might also be trying to share a racial epithet on that. But yeah, there are ways that you can kind of get around that. If you're looking to get content from a specific user, you can use a web service that will pull their info. But to me, it's also like, the more I do stuff like that, the more it still kind of validates the Twitter experience as being something desirable. And I'm even trying to just back off from like, oh, someone posted this thing on Twitter. Then I don't want to share it. I'll talk about another website that's reporting on it, but I don't want to go to Twitter as like the place for breaking news now. It's not what it used to be. It's not that anymore. Well, so Antonio, this is kind of the thing that you... So I don't want to get too bogged down in, oh, but both sides bad kind of political conversations. Antonio has a very legitimate concern as to what kind of content Antonio would like to consume. I'm avoiding Mastodon because I only see left-wing people talk about it. I don't want another echo chamber. It's why I'm hesitant on Rumble because it's only right-wing and libertarians on there. You make the experience you want. And the reason why I'm mad at Twitter and at Reddit are because they removed tools that allowed me to craft the experience that I want. So if you go to Mastodon, Mastodon is not one thing. It is not a singular server of content. It is a loose federation, a loose collection of pockets of content. And you go and follow the people that you want. I recommend people go to Mastodon and put in a couple hashtags. Remember, you know, hashtag this was a joke. But when you create a hashtag, it creates a link to a topic that you would want to follow. And we've got to spell this stuff back out for people because you're so used to algorithms just serving you the content that I think a lot of people have forgotten how to search. Search is now becoming the big thing on TikTok. TikTok is becoming a huge search engine for topics where younger and younger people are starting to look for that direct video connection to a specific topic by only going to TikTok and searching for that topic. You can do that on Mastodon. You can make Mastodon anything you want it to be, and you can do it like we used to be able to do on Twitter. I would always point out, Twitter is a cesspool. Twitter was always a cesspool, But I made Twitter the tech conversation landscape that I wanted it to be. So my echo chamber is right to repair legislation, free open source software, broadband rollout initiatives. Yeah, a lot of those things are often presented as left-wing topics. But if you're a right-wing rationalist, you have to appreciate, hey, it's better when we've got loose touch regulation in this field. Hey, it's better when there's a free and open, a more fair playing field for startups to compete against major corporations. Hey, it's really great that I don't have an algorithm standing on my neck to prevent people from seeing my content. So go follow what you want. Consume the content that you want, and Mastodon gives you better tools to do that for free. And if you want to be nice, I contribute a little bit of money to my Mastodon instance because I'm not running those servers. People actively run those servers, not a massive corporation. So you actually kind of become a shareholder in how you want the future of that instance to be managed. If you give some feedback to Twitter, do you think anyone's going to pay attention to you there? No. But if you've got some legit feedback to send to the host of your Mastodon instance, great. And if they don't take your advice, you can go to a different Mastodon server. You can go to a server that does reflect your values and does respect your input. It's all available. But again, there's this perception that like, oh, but that's for techie people and nerds and it's so hard. And I bet it's all just full of those liberals. And you're like, no. It's like anyone who says that hasn't actually tried to use Mastodon. If you've actually tried to earnestly participate in Mastodon, you would see that all of that's false. That whole narrative is that it's hard to use, that you're only going to get this echo chamber of content, that like it's only the angry liberals that left Twitter or over on Mastodon. Uh-uh. I run into every flavor of the political spectrum on Mastodon. Especially right now with everything that's going on in the world, there is a lot of complicated discussion when it comes to topics of politics and human rights and technology and social media. But you wouldn't know that. You don't know that until you give it a shot. And that's not, I signed up for a Mastodon account and then I didn't get any content to read. You really got to use it. But again, people are just sort of fine supporting fascists on Twitter. Make sure that you keep giving Elon Musk your time, your attention, your effort. And then when Twitter totally crashes, if Twitter ever does totally crash, we'll all be like, oh, but what do we do now? I guess we'll go to Threads. Oh, yeah, Dr. Cloud. I mean, like, the tricky thing is, like, so I believe Rumble was actually built. Was it Rumble or was it Truth Social? I can't remember. It was one of those, like, hardcore right-wing, we're going to share the truth on the internet. But then it was like, oh, but if you say anything that's adjacent to centrist or left-wing politics, we're going to mute you and censor you. Dr. Kloss says there are some actual left-wingers on Rumble just because YouTube was eating the poo-poo, but most of its users are there to escape the perceived liberal bubble. I want to say one of them was actually built to be a Mastodon server, and then it was defederated because so many awful and toxic people were trying to use that as a wedge to overly influence other Mastodon instances. And that's one of the big no-nos. You don't go to a Mastodon server and then you start like hyping and promoting an ideology, and you know, you got to read the room. But other servers can decide like, hey, if all you're doing is spreading misinformation, we're not going to integrate with your server and let you spread bad information to our server. And that's in its own form, it's its own way of content moderation that is way more effective than anything that Twitter has rolled out. I mean, Antonio, show me someone who hasn't. Antonio says, it's fair that I haven't used Mastodon, but it's not encouraging when its proponent trashes other platforms. I mean, where are we wrong? Facebook is responsible for promoting genocidal movements in other countries, and they have become the AOL-style front page to internet with a highly manipulative scheme where we've already seen the scientific data that Facebook published that their main mission was to make you angry and miserable because then you would stay on Facebook longer. we're watching every shred of Twitter's reputation get burned by Elon Musk. Like, at what point is it trashing, or at what point is it just fairly assessing how toxic those environments have become? We're looking at every single regulator in every region of the world starting to take a harsher look at how social media interacts with human psychology, and especially with young people. Why? Because people are getting hurt. So when we have one platform that is a loose collection of operatives that is not one specific flavor, I feel that is a tangible improvement over the landscape of social media. So how is that trashing, right? Trashing to me would be overestimating the damage being done from people like Elon Musk on platforms like Twitter. I think I'm underestimating the potential damage being done by the weaponized spread of misinformation, and especially by how easy it is to manipulate someone like Elon Musk into doing some really terrible and thoughtless things, some really tragic and toxic things. And where do I not find that kind of engagement and manipulation? Over on Mastodon. So I'm going to talk about why I think that's better. And if someone hasn't used Mastodon, I don't really have a lot to say except try to use it in earnest, because you're probably missing out. And if you're that sensitive to people sharing their opinions on how other social media platforms have become more toxic, then I feel like there's a momentum there where you're just not wanting to shift. And that's fine. Stay with what you want to stay with, but don't pretend that that's not getting demonstrably worse and that people have legitimate grievances with how it's getting a lot worse. All right, so that's enough talking about Elon Musk. He's already sucked enough air out of the room. Hold on, let me get back on my order of things here. So someone else was already sharing it in the chat, and this is another one that I'm just trying to catch up with all of the moving pieces, because like in 72 hours, OpenAI went from one of these darlings of the new fad of generative AI to becoming just a shocking turn of events. So I'm going to share this first from Mastodon. Someone shared the actual letter from OpenAI employees. So this is signed by a number of OpenAI employees, but I just want to read off the letter here. To the board of directors at OpenAI, OpenAI is the world's leading AI company. We, the employees of OpenAI, have developed the best models and pushed the field to new frontiers. Our work on AI safety and governance shapes global norms. The products we built are used by millions of people around the world. Until now, the company we work for and cherish has never been in a stronger position. The process through which you terminated Sam Altman and removed Greg Brockman from the board has jeopardized all of this work and undermined our mission and company. Your conduct has made it clear you do not have the competence to oversee OpenAI. When we all unexpectedly learned of your decision, the leadership team of OpenAI acted swiftly to stabilize the company. They carefully listened to your concerns and tried to cooperate with you on all grounds. Despite many requests for specific facts for your allegations, you have never provided any written evidence. They also increasingly realized you were not capable of carrying out your duties and were negotiating in bad faith. The leadership team suggested that the most stabilizing path forward, the one that would best serve our mission, company, stakeholders, employees, and the public, would be for you to resign and put in place a qualified board that could lead the company forward in stability. Leadership worked with you around the clock to find a mutually agreeable outcome, yet within 2 days of your initial decision, you again replaced interim CEO Mira Murati against the best interests of the company. You also informed the leadership team that allowing the company to be destroyed would be, quote, consistent with the mission. Now, this is all in bolded text. Your actions have made it obvious that you are incapable of overseeing OpenAI. We are unable to work with or for, unable to work for or with people that lack competence, judgment, and care for our mission and employees. We, the undersigned, may choose to resign from OpenAI and join the newly announced Microsoft subsidiary run by Sam Altman and Greg Brockman. Microsoft has assured us that there are positions for all OpenAI employees at this new subsidiary should we choose to join. We take this step imminently unless all current board members resign, and the board appoints two new lead independent directors, such as Brett Taylor and William Hurd, and reinstates Sam Altman and Greg Brockman. Now, this was published earlier, and then literally this morning, we got all the headlines, Microsoft hires Sam Altman after OpenAI fails to bring back ex-CEO. This was written up by Steve Goldstein over at MarketWatch. Capping a tumultuous weekend, Microsoft said it's hiring Sam Altman to lead a new advanced artificial intelligence research team as OpenAI turns to Emmett Shear to run the organization. The news comes as ChatGPT maker OpenAI considered bringing Altman back into the fold before deciding on Shear, the former chief executive of the video game service Twitch. The Wall Street Journal reported that the reason the talks between OpenAI and Sam Altman failed was the former CEO's insistence that the current board resigns. This is maybe the most collectively bargained threat letter I've ever seen from the employees at a company. And this one is critically important because it is a clear shot at the board of directors of the company. This is internal corporate warfare that I don't know that I've ever seen play out as publicly. And it's also kind of one of those tip of the spear kinds of conversations. We do not have faith in the executive leadership. We're the people operating this company. We're the ones running how this company works. And we're trying to get guidance from executives who, I mean, like, I don't know anything about Shear, but I don't know that I want the guy who used to run Twitch at the head of an AI company. And if I were an engineer working on the future of language learning models and generative AI, I don't know that that would be a path. I don't know that that would be synergy. That doesn't sound like a good fit to me. I am grossly oversimplifying complicated business relationships, and I am not a developer in the AI space. I'm a media and entertainment guy. I'm streaming this on Twitch right now. So I don't have a qualified voice to weigh in on the ins and outs of this type of move. But to me, this is one of the most fascinating aspects of watching employees at a company say, "We're gone if you do not change out the executive leadership." Over the last year, we have seen so many tech layoffs, and I'm real tired of a CEO getting $100 million bonuses, going out to say, "Hey, shareholders, investors, you know, we really let you down this year. Our stock is down, sales are down, profits are down. We did not foresee that the pandemic wouldn't last indefinitely, and that people wouldn't be buying crazy tech stuff permanently with line goes up economics, right? We thought we would always see cancerous growth in this market, and we let you down. So I take full responsibility for the short-sightedness of our company. And in taking full responsibility, I am going to step back from my CEO compensation. I'm only going to take my bonus this year of hundreds of millions of dollars. And to make sure that line goes up and that you make more money on your investment, I'm going to lay off thousands of people. But I take responsibility for that decision in making the lives of thousands of our employees demonstrably worse. It's my responsibility to take that initiative on your behalf, shareholders. When we really start talking about kind of the reverse of class warfare, it's employees at a company like this directly attacking the board and the CEO that the board just appointed and saying, "You're dead without us. We're gone." And this is such a delicious little change in the flavor of commentary that we often get out of startups and Silicon Valley type, angel investor type setups and stuff. I feel like the last generation of, you know, the break stuff, move fast, disrupt kind of tech bro scene was really built on that ideology of the rugged individualist, and we're going to do this to disrupt things and you know, new paradigms, and I'm going to reinvent the taxi, but then make it worse. You couldn't really get everyone in that company to kind of agree on a path or on a strategy. All of the rugged individualists within that company would each have their own I don't know what word I want to use there. They would each have their own philosophy, their own tolerance for how bad that company might get, or they might just genuinely agree with what that company might be trying to accomplish. I don't know. Someone correct me here. I don't know if I've ever seen anything nearly as unified, nearly as coordinated, saying, get rid of the executives. Because time and time again, a lot of the massive problems that we've been seeing over the last year have been poor executive leadership. Poor executive leadership from people that have golden parachutes. If they step down, well, okay, they're still going to be millionaires or billionaires. I mean, look at what happened with that game engine. Unity. It's like, they're already dead to me. the CEO stepped down, but they're now having to talk about massive layoffs because, well, a lot of game developers said, no, we don't want to use your product anymore. We're going to start seeking out alternatives. We're not going to be signing these licensing agreements, and we don't trust that you won't try and rug pull us later. And look at what just happened with Sam Bankman-Fried. Again, it was like, hey, you gambled with our money. This was a misappropriation of funds. You're probably going to be in jail for 100 years. Move fast, break stuff doesn't work. It's the same as it's the Silicon Valley version of like trickle-down economics. It doesn't work. It makes some rich people richer, but then it's unsustainable. And eventually there's going to be a bill to pay. And if you're the one left holding the bag at the end of the dance, if you're the one at the end of the song and you can't get to your musical chair, then you're the one that's out all that money. And then, of course, all these rugged individualists go running for handouts from the government because, you know, they're libertarians until they're not. And then they turn into socialists. But their socialism is different than other people's socialism. Like, was it Silicon Valley Bank? Oh, what a great way for people in Silicon Valley to invest in projects they really care about. And we're really going to feel, oh, wait, no, we're completely insolvent. Federal government, help, we need monies. Every single time. We need people who can disrupt, but it's lopsided. And right now, I think we're starting to see these collectivist ideas start sprouting at these companies to say, like, hey, you know what? I want to be in this for me, and I want to be affluent, and I want to make good money, and I still want to contribute to these products, but like everything those suits are doing in the C-suite is bad for what I'm working on. And I don't trust they really have a plan to see us through this. And now we don't have the free money, no interest rate loans coming to tech companies in Silicon Valley. Now companies actually have to put their money on the line. And when rich people have to put their money on the line, well, suddenly this conversation changes a little bit. I've been hearing some stuff like this too. Simon says, Hypno says, I read that Altman wants to plow forward with AI to monetize and the board wanted to rein it in a little bit. So I don't have good sources, because I've been trying to read through just as much as I can. This is news that is like unfolding in real time. By the time you catch the replay of this podcast, we'll probably have a ton more info and confirmation or differences on what they said this and this happened then and this is what's going to happen. The he said, she said, or the he said of Silicon Valley companies and AI. Here's the problem with AI as I see it. In a very similar fashion to the peak of cryptocurrencies and NFTs, the current implementation of, hey, it's so cute if I type in a prompt on a website and then I get some information back from that website, and it's something I can maybe turn into an article or use as the backbone for my script or something like that. What we see is this delightful, kitschy little interaction. And it's funny when the AI hallucinates and gets stuff wrong. And it's really funny when you type in, hey, can you write a speech in the style of Leonard Nimoy playing Spock? And like it gives you a very logical style of speech. And that's really cool. It is an order of magnitude more compute power to absorb all that information, keep it in this bucket of operations and this bucket of data points that the AI can rely on, then manipulate all of that language to spew out a facsimile, a copy of what we think that language would kind of look like. And it's usually a mediocre copy, unless you're very, very good at crafting the prompts to get the right operators and to get the right information out of the AI. It is already a Herculean effort to do things like search. Adding language learning models on top of that is incredible energy and performance usage. The amount of hardware you need to do that is incredible. And I know I've brought this up in podcasts before, but there was that little bit of an inside Microsoft executive conversation where they were talking about, could Microsoft get into the nuclear power business to better power the future of their AI initiatives? To me, that is not an earnest request from an executive at Microsoft, but the fact is they were looking at that as some kind of fact-finding. Someone had to say, like, well, wait a minute, if it's using this much power, could we just build our own nuclear reactor? I don't believe that's an earnest pitch. Like, I don't think executives at Microsoft are saying, like, we're going to get into the nuclear power business. But more, that's what we're starting, like, that's where your brain goes. How do we craft enough silicon? How do we power all of those data centers? How do we cool them? Where's a part of the world where we can leech on their water rights to make sure that our data centers are properly supplied? It's a mess. So I would not be surprised if Altman was looking at this saying, like, hey, we're burning our runway. We're not bringing in enough money to fully support what we're doing. We're in that beginner phase of a really hot new tech where we're getting people to use it and it's super, super cool. But you know, the prices are low or they're free and we're really impressing people. The window on AI being fun and cool is going to be so much smaller than any other tech fad because of how much energy it takes, all the resources that you need to utilize to deliver this experience. And that to me is where the novelty really starts falling apart. Is like, it's fun and kitschy now if I just kind of dabble with it or I play with like a Microsoft AI or Bing Chat or something like that. I very rarely get useful information out of it. But if I had to start paying for that and it was still just kind of okay, that's not worth it for me. And it's also in the back of my brain knowing that it's like servers are melting internationally. And energy suppliers are fueling this kind of content. I don't think it's really worth all the effort we're putting into it just yet. I feel like I think we arrived a little too early at Gen AI without the efficiency and the hardware components that would really facilitate a more daily driver utilization of this kind of tech. So Simon says Hypno. I'm sorry. I know that was a really rambling examination of that. But I would not be surprised if Altman was saying, we really do need to start making more money on this stuff because the energy bills are getting kind of... And who left the lights on in the break room? Oh, man, it's tough. Goat V8, this is another thing that I love, too. It's a very credible and actionable threat from the OpenAI employees because they have a place to go. It's good to see. If these executives are too comfortable in their positions on boards and as CEOs, it's nice to occasionally remind them they are not the ones doing the work. They are the ones who are supposed to guide the direction of the ship and give the orders to the people, to crew, to get the work done. And their crew right now are mutinying, and they have another ship they could potentially go to. And that, to me, is a great turn of events. We want to see competition. We want to see leveraged negotiating. And at some point, you say, no, not this time. This is bad. Yeah, Brian, this is exactly what I was trying to sum up there. We just don't know enough directly from Altman and OpenAI. And really, at this point, I don't know that it matters. We'll never get the clear, full scoop on exactly what was said between these two parties while negotiating. I've been in way too many negotiations between different media entities to ever... Like, you see what people say about media companies in the press, and you're like, that's not how that went down at all. I can't tell you about it, but that's not reflective of reality in the slightest. I love it. All right, so, that's what we were just covering, Simon Sisson. Microsoft just hired Altman, and they are always working in our best interests. No, Microsoft is always working in Microsoft's interests, but Microsoft also has a significant interest in this space, and the OpenAI team completely left a barn door open for Microsoft to just kind of stroll in and be like, I want that horse and that horse and that horse, and I want all of your dairy cows, and I'll also take all your hay bales. You should have closed the barn door. That was a terrible metaphor for AI. It's hilarious. All right. I'm going to cover one more story, then we're going to jump into that MediaTek interview. I'm really excited to share that MediaTek interview with y'all. But this one's also going to take a little bit of time just to chat through. Apple caved on RCS. Apple finally is bringing iMessage up to modern communication standards. And instead of being the company that could have directed the entire future of messaging, server-side messaging, they have always used iMessage as a pain point to force families to spend more on iPhones than if they were getting, you know, sort of more appropriate Android phones for their kids. And I'm kind of curious what people's thoughts are now that Apple has finally announced that it will be coming in 2024. I'm of the mind that very little will change. You still have all the green bubble bullying because Apple needs people to bully on their behalf. It is a massive component of iPhone marketing is all of the kids coming up who are only interested in iPhones and maintaining their peer groups with blue bubbles here in North America. And all of the parents that also kind of contribute to that. I posted that editorial of the mom who sort of green bubble bullied my wife. And I don't think any of that's going to change. Now, what I think is kind of interesting is hearing the reports that Apple will be looking at a future method of encryption. They aren't just going to be using Google's total profile for end-to-end encryption. They will be working with Google to secure messaging on iPhones. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, see, I knew it, and they weren't going to do it, and Google bad, and blah, blah, blah. But if you were an iPhone user, that also meant you were fine not having end-to-end encryption whenever you would text with an Android because your fallback was SMS. So let's not get so up in your feels about Google bad when Apple was worse. Apple is now just catching up to the beginning of a rollout on RCS. So here are the questions. Do we think that Apple will further find pain points, because they are supposedly going to use the universal profile of RCS, but I think they're still going to break stuff. Like media messaging, for one. I bet you will see some teething pains if I try to send a photo to an iPhone user of iMessage had a problem, but it'll make it look like my Android couldn't send the file to the iPhone. But then also, if we'll be able to craft an encrypted solution. And then my last one here, do we think Apple is going to wait to roll out RCS until the next iPhone launch? Because you would need to buy a whole new iPhone because RCS is just so inefficient. We needed to craft a whole new powerful chip and an A18 Pro Bionic Plus. Just so that you could RCS, because, you know, if it were up to us, we would have used a gooder standard like iMessage to keep everything easy. But those evil regulators made us use the RCS, and now your iPhones can't handle having communication on your phone that a $200 Android has no problems with. So I'm gonna take a quick drink of water here. I bet you RCS doesn't come to the iPhone until the next generation of iOS is released. That's my guess. I'm going to put that out there. That is my estimation of how poorly Apple will treat their own customers in this space.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people. producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey, Juan, and hey, guys. Thank you for having me. And this is Thunder E from Bored at Work. Now, if you don't know me or don't know my channel, Bored at Work has been around for about 10 years or so on YouTube, and I cover an array of really cool tech items. I like to see things that, you know, we all want to get, want to buy, want to try out. And for me, that revolves around a lot of gaming as well. So I do gaming on smartphones, gaming on consoles, as well as also gaming on PCs, doing some PC builds as well. So if you like all that kind of stuff, you definitely check it out. Plus, I'm a big audio guy. I love my headphones, just like Juan, who loves his audio. Yes, we can talk about audio all day. And I have a rather large collection, about 50, maybe 52 headphones, but I love to review them and find out the best ones you guys can go ahead and try out. So if you want to see more of that stuff, go ahead and check out Bored at Work, spelled B-O-O-R-E-D-A-T-W-O-R-K. So Bored at Work with two O's. And thank you, Juan, for having me, and back to you.
All right, Goat V8, I'm wondering how they'll apple it to make it seem better. I don't think they will. I think they'll make RCS demonstrably worse on the iPhone than it is on an Android. But I'm still waiting to see how. And I bet you a part of that is going to be harming the media experience so that, I mean, like, it's only been because of people like me. I've been showing photos at my daughter's school. Like, there's an event. Like, if you were on the Patreon, I shared video of their Dia de los Muertos party. They had this really beautiful fiesta. And, like, the kids put so much work into crafting these little ofrendas. And I was sharing that video and sharing photos from that event immediately with the other Android users. There are a couple moms that have Pixels and a few that have Samsungs. We're nearby sharing like crazy. It's great. And then a mom would come up with like an iPhone and you're like, I can't send you this photo. This is what the photo really looks like. Let me text it to you. Do you see how garbage that is? That's your phone's fault. And so now I have two moms that were like, oh, can you take my photo and I'll do this thing? And like, I go and walk over with them and you want me to take it with your iPhone? And they're like, no, you should take it from that phone that you have. And then it's like, all right, well, if you want this photo, give me your email address because I can't just text it to you. It'll look like garbage. I really do believe there is a statistically significant number of iPhone users who do not know how good Android cameras are because they're stuck in this sort of green bubble fight. And of course, this is mostly a North American commentary. There's going to be someone in here who's already, oh, this is such a North American thing. I don't know. The rest of the world uses WhatsApp because we love Facebook. Meta. Sorry, that got snarky. Yes, because I live in North America. And yes, because I have to put up with peer groups for my daughter and parents, and this is just a necessary component of dealing with the social psychology of Apple's toxic marketing in the United States. Of course. If I lived somewhere else, I would be with you saying, doesn't affect me, but guess what it does? And this is my podcast. If you want to run the Things That Don't Bother Me podcast, you can run your own podcast. Simon says, Hypno, Apple just invented RCS. Gabaletta, Apple will absolutely find ways to make it harder to send and receive to and from a non-iOS device. Simon, 35% better messaging, only on your new iPhone 17 Pro Plus LMNOP edition. Wade County, I agree with you. Apple will create new features on iMessage and promote the hell out of it to appease their fan base. So when we saw iPhones get USB-C, they only talked about like, oh, and now you can do this direct recording off of SSD drives on the iPhone. Isn't that so handy? Oh, and also it's like the same cable that the rest of the world is using. And I think that's what they're going to do to RCS. Like, oh, look, in iMessage, now you can do this. In iMessage, you can send people money and do payments, and you get all this great stuff. And then also the fallback is RCS so that you can talk to an Android person and see people type. It'll totally be that, like, totally, let's just kind of tuck that under the rest of the announcement, but we'll acknowledge it. We just won't make a lot of noise about it. Oh, Kappa Cash, I know. The media is already making Apple look like they saved Android with this RCS. And it's on us to also just kind of remind people, when you complain about your messaging experience, it's been Apple's fault. Apple could have defined the standard that we all use for RCS, but instead, they ratcheted their own customers to get more money out of them for their products and services and made their experience worse just so that their customers would go out and bully other people to try and get them to use iPhones instead. Baseball Super, what's an example of green bubble bullying? Go to somegadgetguide.com and I have an editorial. So just search for green bubble and you'll find the thing that happened between my wife and another parent. I mean, this podcast is already running long and I do want to get to the MediaTek interview here. Yeah, Brian Glaze, yeah. Ambiguous graphs, 35% better messaging than the previous year. Goat V8, RCS or Signal, that's the only way. This is the one thing that I actually hope we'll see from the EU, putting more regulatory pressure on interoperability. Someone else came in and said, like, oh, just use WhatsApp like everybody else. And, like, I don't want to do business with Meta, especially for my private communications. I don't trust them at all. But if the EU is able to manipulate Apple's business strategy, hopefully this is putting pressure on Facebook too. So if you're a WhatsApp user, you still need to be critically interested in what's happening with iMessage, because that's also going to be a part of the conversation that comes to WhatsApp. If you don't want WhatsApp to fully descend into the in-poopification that Facebook has planned for it, and the ads that they want to serve, and the ratcheting of your user data and your user behavior, and the opt-in versus opt-out toxic elements of a platform like Facebook, you need to hope that this is also a part of the strategy to examine Facebook and Meta's business practices. So don't, I mean, this isn't completely off the radar for you too. Oh, but Americans, they use iMessage and that's so dumb. I'm not even going to be bothered by it. Pay attention, because it's coming for other services too. And what we want is a server-side messaging platform that maybe all uses RCS as a fallback. Just like we used to all have kind of SMS as a fallback, what if you wanted to use Signal and this person wanted to use Telegram and this person's on WhatsApp, but you could all plug in and see typing, have better coordinated chats, better multimedia sharing. You pick the front end, but if I'm not on the same service as you, I can fall back to RCS and we can all still communicate with rich content. I think that would be a plus. And if we can make Apple do it, then we'll get better messaging capabilities for WhatsApp. We'll get better messaging capabilities for Signal and Telegram and text messenger and whatever else that you might use on your phone. If there's a way that we can just plug in and say, yeah, this is my SIM, this is my phone number, this is my media account, and now I've got like an email login and I can just go right in here and now I'm chatting with my friends like nothing has changed. And they don't care what service I'm using, and I don't care what service they're using. This, to me, would be the best eventuality that we actually create a standard. Funny that, right? Like, if we had just a standard, we could all operate on the same standard, and then we could just pick whatever sort of front end we wanted for that standard. Oh, Gabaletta, yeah. We're talking about this too. As a parent of two kids who will inevitably need a connected device, I fear that as a non-Apple household, my kid might end up getting bullied because they don't have an iPhone because of the whole green bubble and FaceTime thing. And we're having those same conversations, Marie and I. My daughter's 8, and I feel like we're probably going to be leaning into some kind of dumb phone in a couple of years. And she's already been using that smartphone watch, the TikTok, not the TikTok. That connected watch has been really great for helping to teach her a little bit about phone etiquette and messaging. And she's starting to kind of grasp like some of the behavior around having something that can communicate with other people. But at some point, we're going to have to look like what her peer groups are doing and what kind of kid she turns out to be. If it's just too much of a chore or too much of a task to keep fighting against peer groups that leave her out of messages. I mean, at one point, I also feel like parents will probably need to say, like, okay, no connected devices for students. Like, if you can't have nice things, if you can't use them appropriately, and you're using these things to, like, bully your classmates, then no one gets anything. Just burn it all to the ground. We only allow students at this school to have flip phones. Again, like, parents won't do that. And they'll be after, like, but I need this for my kid, and blah, blah, blah. You're like, if you can't use it appropriately, you take it away. Oh, Goat V8. Yeah, I mean, it's rampant. And again, iPhone owners don't seem to understand that, like, the worst members of the iPhone community see no problem with this. Goat V8, my sister works a government job with professionals who complain that she makes a green bubble chat. It's insane. And this is the run-in that my wife had with that other mom. Android users, like, genuinely, I have not seen people complain about green or blue bubble messaging. And in Google Messages, now we just get all of the little emoji reactions and stuff. Like, we don't get the duplicated so-and-so laughed at a photo. Like, we're on a current messaging standard that can interpret that and give me the little emoji. We're doing fine. But the iPhone owners have no trouble commenting on and complaining about the phones other people use. Like, it's just fine to just, like, oh, there's another Android in the chat. You're like, yeah, F off. And Wade County completely nails it. The worst is they think they're talking techie by mentioning green bubbles, but if you try to explain the issue, why are you getting so defensive? You're one of those angry Android users. And you're like, you're the one that's been complaining about the color of my text bubbles. So I'm not going to take photos of your kid at school events. Look at all these amazing photos and videos, but none for you. Because I wouldn't want to pollute your text feed with these horrible green bubbles. Michael Corcoran, I would flip that. Michael Corcoran writes, Meta is almost as objectionable as a company as Apple, maybe even worse. I think Meta is definitely worse. I feel like Apple has gone down a corporate path that I viscerally disagree with a lot of their executive leadership and their business practices, but I feel Meta has been built from the ground up to be sort of the worst flavor of how all of this stuff works. So I feel you on that. I would immediately go to, I feel Meta is worse for people than Apple is. Here, let me get this out of the way here. So what I want to do, we can kind of take a brief detour. And I have this great interview with MediaTek executives. And when we come out the other side of that conversation, I'd love to just sit and talk for just a little bit longer. This podcast is always running long anyway, where we can chat some of the tech we're thankful for. So let me cue this up. I might have to mute my mic. So this could get a little bit weird. Just as I get it started, you might hear a couple extra little clicks. But this is me sitting down with Dr. Finbar Moynihan and DS Xu from MediaTek, their marketing and their AI development teams, respectively. And we were talking a little bit about OpenAI and some of the power concerns. There were some of those concerns for the future of our mobile devices. If we're going to do on-device AI, what kind of resources are we looking at to facilitate that on-device AI experience? And how will that run on a pocket computer that also needs to be our communication device? So I'm going to click this over. We'll let this interview play out and then come on back. I'm still going to be in the chat. I'm not going anywhere. But you know, especially if you have any questions about what they're saying, and I can kind of elaborate on that. So here is my interview with two MediaTek executives. And I'll catch you back on the other side of the interview.
I should be able to clear out that air conditioning noise with
one. Do you want to do some
No, actually, I don't, because I'm overheating.
Okay.
And I know you guys have been running around too, so let's just stay comfortable. Okay. Better to have a little bit of room ambiance.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me on this conversation. Hopefully, introduce yourselves and what roles you play at MediaTek for my audience.
Sure. I'll start. So I'm Finbar Moynihan. I run corporate marketing for MediaTek.
Yeah, my name is Dasha. I am from MediaTek Research. It's a dedicated research center on AI.
we've already gotten a lot of news about Dimensity 9300. My channel is really mobile focused. I kind of want to start with something a little bit more of a premise. In my circles of family and friends, I don't think any of them can conceptualize 10 to 15% performance improvements. I feel like for the last several years, these devices have become so powerful. But if I try to ask them about things like what would make their phone experience better, they immediately reply with things like battery.
It's a very good question. And I think it's something we think and obsess a lot about, right? So obviously it's sort of maybe a little easy to market some of those kind of headline numbers that you were talking about. But, you know, actually what we focus more on is what you just described, right? How do we improve the usage? How do we improve the consumer experience? You know, the days of use, the average power consumption for both low tasks, or let's say not very demanding tasks, but also at the other extreme for, you know, super high-end demanding, high-end gaming or whatever it might be, right? And so we've seen, at least with Dimensity 9300, probably something in the 10 to 15% range improvement for all of those. And that's just going to translate directly into battery usage. If you do the same thing with the previous generation flagship phone, the new generation phone, it will last 10 to 15% longer. But I think much more important is what you said is the experiences that we can bring.
Right.
Like there's a major step function in gaming with this platform.
Okay.
So the whole mobile gaming experience, from everything from the graphics that's integrated, you know, our all big core CPU architecture, new memory interfaces, you put all that together, you're going to see a very big step function in gaming.
What is MediaTek's relationship like with your customers? Because you're not selling a thing directly to my my parents, right? You're sort of in a market with the device manufacturers. And I fear that there is a pressure from the phone and handset manufacturers chasing Antutu scores. Because they know it's going to get those headlines. We've been promised that before, where if you use your device the same way that you did on your old device, you'll get 30% more battery life. But as the end users, we don't really get to define that. I don't have a button on my phone that says, use this like a Dimensity 1000.
I think for us, it's been a journey. I mean, MediaTek is obviously the largest vendor of mobile chipsets by volume. But up to a few years ago, we were not really present in the flagship part of the market. And I think that's a very unique and very different part of the market, because there's a lot more care goes into all of the other components, the camera, the memories, the displays, all the things that are going to give that flagship experience. And that's a much tighter, much closer relationship with the OEMs right from the start of the design process to get all of those things right. I think we are now in our third generation in flagship. So we had the 9000, the Dimensity 9200, now the 9300. Those relationships have been built, right? So you see Vivo, Oppo, Xiaomi, all of these, you know, customers launching phones based on our flagship. They've invested in the platform. They've built up that capability internally to deliver high-end products based on MediaTek. So there's a very close collaboration with those companies as they design the phones to try to hit those kind of user experiences that they want to hit. Of course, at the end of the day, we're delivering a platform. We have awesome AI experience. We have a really unique computing architecture. We have, you know, great camera technology, great connectivity, great gaming, whatever. It doesn't mean that we expect all of those to be enhanced and prioritized by every OEM on every device. Of course, each customer has to make the decisions of where they're going to invest, where they're going to differentiate, where they're going to put the focus. Our job is to give them the ability to do that with the platform. Not least of which I think is AI.
Well, I definitely have some questions about that too, because I feel like there are some concerns in how AI, how you approach AI in a mobile device. How do we balance this AI trend and the popularity of this AI trend against a mobile device with very limited power configurations in a pocket computer that someone has to live their whole day in?
Compared to 5G, 5G has the long roadmap, and you know it will happen eventually. But AI, you know, changes very rapidly. What you hear, what you think is fantastic, early half a year, it becomes very commonplace. And and that, when you put that kind of a pace of innovation, contrast that with how we have to make process, provides from planning to shipping it may take 2 to 3 years. It actually is very difficult for us to predict what, you know, is the ideal highway that you want to invest into, and the process do you balance the 1,000 of CPU to the APU or 1,000 to 10,000? That's right. A really hard question.
And to know that 3 years in advance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's quite hard. 3 years ago, maybe you were saying that we need to do all this convolution network mm-hmm. and make it run very well. And well, 3 years later, actually, very few people care about convolution networks.
And the trend has changed. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's one. The good thing is that if you guess wrong, you're not the only one that guessed wrong. Everybody
right.
don't have this foresight. The AI and the phone and mobile industry, we're always just trying to learn what should people be allowed to expect. What should you want mm-hmm. that can happen on a phone? Can you expect to draw a photo, an image using Stable Diffusion in 1 second? Well, we got that. Yeah. Can you draw one after another for 1,000 photo images? We probably don't know.
Isn't that such a critical consumer expectation, though? Like, I'm playing around with the new Pixel, and Google obviously is pushing this conversation very aggressively. But so much of that is dependent on uploading server side, mm-hmm. which again kind of dovetails with part of this 5G conversation. If I'm not in good data and I can't do a stylized photo on my Pixel without a strong.
But I think to add to what DS was saying, I think while we may not predict the absolute optimal hardware in the first generation, mm-hmm. we have some idea of where things are going.
Of course.
But also when you look at the capabilities, because again, these kind of capabilities like start at the flagship and of course over time they'll move into other tiers.
Of course.
But there's so much other computing capability, CPU capability, GPU capability, mm-hmm. that's quite flexible. So you could probably do a lot of other things. You may not be able to do them in the best optimized hardware accelerator. You may not be able to do them with the best power consumption capabilities. But that will come in Gen 2.
But someone isn't left out in the cold.
Somebody isn't left out with that experience, you know. So I think about it from the perspective of, like, say, call it traditional AI, where a lot of what we do today on computational photography started mm-hmm. with just still images. Mm-hmm. Now we're applying it to video and gaming as well, right? So because we did the power consumption, we did the second generation.
Giving you more flexibility to kind of staple some things.
I think some of that will happen with the Gen AI trend as well.
Yeah.
Well, and MediaTek is in this kind of in-between position because you are relating these experiences to device manufacturers. I'm sure you're getting feedback from all of the platforms that are trying to join this AI race, not just like one language learning model company. Everybody is contacting. I have to believe this is a very complicated conversation.
Yep.
And you're sort of the switchboard operator facilitating these experiences. One of the concerns that came up a lot when I kind of put it out there for my patrons, just like, hey, do you have any questions? Like put a MediaTek exec on the spot. Some of the messaging that we're seeing, AI improves when not only do you have these APU or neural processing or machine learning components, you have additional CPU power, GPU power. Mm-hmm. But we're also starting to get a little bit of that chuckle of, well, here's a phone that's coming out next year, 24 gigs of RAM. Mm-hmm. That's not going to impact anyone's daily use. I have to believe that is a forward-looking assessment of what AI might require in a couple of years. How do you respond to some of those concerns where to get something on my phone, which is going to be a novelty to start, but will hopefully become a new feature that we depend on for our phones, requires a 50% investment in these components and fluctuating RAM and storage prices. How does MediaTek handle that conversation when we could be looking at years before people are really gravitating to these experiences?
Yeah, I think your guess is perfectly right that the normal use of a phone really does not require you to have like 24 gig RAM.
Right.
And the most plausible reason for that, I'm not in the room now, AM, so I don't know why they're doing it.
Correct.
Is because they imagine that there are certain use cases that require more than one very large model collaborating with each other. Mm-hmm. So you need to have those models resident in your memory. Now remember that the traditional AI, up until a few years ago, they mostly used, like Bimba said, to make what you could have done better. But with generative AI, we just switch into just doing entirely new things. So I think that this is new thing versus enhancement that it really spurred the motivation to bet on perhaps after you have your phone for one year, then something blockbuster comes out and you don't need to go out buy something else. Your phone already can support it. I do think that they have certain of they must have certain of these applications and running on the prototype in their own lab that drive their such decisions to say, let's just equip it with more RAM because the trend is going down.
So that doesn't become as much of a conversation coming back to you until these trends have already sort of been established.
I mean, ultimately, the amount of RAM that goes into a phone is an OEM decision. It's not a MediaTek decision.
Right.
Obviously, we have to provision the device to support that. For example, the Dimensity 9300 has support for the latest and greatest LPDDR5T. So we're giving people the fastest available, widest data pipe for bandwidth.
But in the AI conversations, you guys have set out potential operations, the number.
Yeah, I think I have to correct that because I'm from MediaTek research, not from MediaTek business operation.
Right.
So my mission was to look at the mobile industry as a whole, actually not really even limited to MediaTek. How would the industry move forward so we can be prepared for that early in advance? So it's very, very, very likely that there is this dialogue and there is this understanding, just that they don't propagate to me.
Where I think we come in, and we probably didn't get into this in a lot of detail in the session this morning, is we understand that the generative AI trend is going to drive the need for much more memory on device or at the edge. That's for sure. These models are huge, gigabytes of data.
Well, I don't even think us tech reviewers are prepared.
Yeah.
A lot of us are just getting up to speed on this as a trend and to see what to facilitate these kinds of experiences.
Yeah.
A lot of what we've done has been server side.
Yeah. And we've taken 13 billion parameter models.
Yeah.
Which, if you do nothing, requires something in the order of 13 gigabytes of RAM. Right? Now, what we do, of course, is quantize, pruning, all the classic techniques that this guy, I'm sure, knows a lot better than I do. But also, we've built hardware decompression into the latest APU. So we can do some further compression of the models with the software tools. And then as the data is coming off the memory onto the chip, we decompress it in hardware in real time. That net-net, we can sort of reduce the requirements by about 60%. But you still get 5 gigabytes of memory. So it's still not a small number when you're talking about these generative AI applications.
Is there an opportunity for MediaTek to drive more of that discussion? Because I worry we're coming in before this has really taken root as something that people expect their phones to do. I worry that some of the commentary will kind of sour the experience before people really get a chance to try it.
Now, I do think that the people in this industry understand the issue. It might not be the number 1, 2, 3 issue they have to solve. They have other issues lining up.
Oh, yeah. It's still a whole bunch of compute products that still need to facilitate.
You go on to the marketplace to download a few characters to compose your game. And this character wants Llama for his, character backend, the other one's Mistral, the other one's something else. Oh, now you have multiple language model you need to support. Yeah. On top of that, you're running voice recognition and speech generation. Well, you do need that much RAM. One obvious solution is to have to standardize a little bit more what is guaranteed performance behavior envelope of these things that you run. So I think that that's where the people working on AI and AI processors would have to figure out that you don't introduce these very fancy operations that gain you a little bit in AI, but make it very hard for hardware to do. And on the other hand, you don't really try to differentiate yourself so much away from others so that the people who only have 12 gigabyte RAM cannot use it.
Obviously, I'm asking you to speculate, but do you feel it's likely that we'll start to see some of that standardization? I know it's like trying to herd a bag of cats. So
much of it is also related to regulations. AI when it comes to hitting with the character behavior, like what mm-hmm. they say and all that, is very regional. So it depends on, we'll probably know, I think probably know better than I did what's going to happen in China and in the US. But everywhere else, it's very large. Question mark.
It's wide open right now.
Yeah, because at this point, if you are building models, competing with others, you want to become white unicorn, can unicorn. you barely do these two languages. Right. You have no time to spend on French.
But at least in the near term, it's probably still like the large US cloud players, the large Chinese cloud players that are probably going to have the resources to do the training that's required for some of these foundation models that are the basis for everything. So,
yeah. And so at some point, someone's going to have to pick a side and sort of follow in a general direction.
Probably, these yeah. market but I agree that there's going to be a lot of regional, you know, Europe is looking at some of this stuff. The US is beginning to look at it, you know, but it probably will be different answers in different regions, I think.
Yeah, I think Minate would definitely have input into what kind of mathematical operation they can use.
Yeah. Mm.
But beyond that, if I can support your models, then exactly which model are going to be loaded onto the phone.
It's
mostly a consumer decision. The winner will dictate that kind of model can use.
So I did get a few questions come in, and I kind of want to ask a few of these. But Body Yi, this was addressed during our presentation today.
Oh, good. So we might know the answer.
Well, but it's the perceptions.
Yeah.
I've been making these kinds of jokes for a little while. You know, like MediaTek, you probably don't know they're already in your home, right? And so Body Yi asked, how does MediaTek see itself in light of its image playing second fiddle to Qualcomm, where for several regions, we'll see a device split and mid-range to this sort of barrier premium, that's where MediaTek is crushing. Mm-hmm. But then invariably an ultra phone will come out where, well, they had to go with the Snapdragon. Where does MediaTek see its position in that point? And where do you think the next steps are to kind of help further illustrate, like, this is a one-to-one competitive. There, I don't believe since the Dimensity 9000, there has been this discrepancy
yeah.
in actual real-world performance.
Yeah. You know, I think I think our CEO said it well this morning, right? Like, we're not resting on our laurels. Like, the Dimensity 9300, I think, is a huge step forward for us, like I said. Mm-hmm. Computing, AI, gaming, you know, we feel like...
Well, this is a really unconventional approach.
Yeah.
This is something that I expected to see on your Chromebook solution.
Yeah. So it's definitely, I think we feel like we sort of hit it like on all cylinders. And it's, you know, this is our third generation. We said when we started the flagship journey, this wasn't a one and done. We understand this is, you know, a cadence of launching a new flagship every year. You know, mm-hmm. we've already announced that we're working with TSMC for 3-nanometer technology
yeah.
for next year's product. So who knows what that's going to bring. But I think, I feel like we have proven that we can deliver the capability. We've proven mm-hmm. we can take on the best of the best in terms of delivering the capabilities that are needed. I think that is being more and more recognized by the industry. We're certainly growing our flagship share. I mean, again, our CEO mentioned this morning, we expect to hit about $1 billion in revenue in flagship this year. Given that that was zero 2 years ago, that's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Of course, he's not happy yet. But I think...
Well, to be fair, in the midst of
what... A bad year overall.
The worst year over year.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what's exciting us, I think, is the high end of the market is growing in many segments, particularly in China. The high-end market, I think, is quite robust, even if the overall market is down in terms of quantity. Mm-hmm. The value is still increasing in certain segments.
Nice.
We are growing share in the flagship market in China. And I think we're only going to take more share as we go into next year. So I would say watch this space.
So this is one. I'm going to read this as it's written. And I feel this will be an educational opportunity to, again, help correct some of the perception. Front-loading this question. Ajanish asks, how far in terms of time are you on achieving parity with Qualcomm for network radio performance and efficiency? And I would imagine your response is likely that you guys
already
are
there.
Yeah. Competitive against Qualcomm. Yeah. One of the things that I've noticed is this more a regional issue when we start looking at some of the players in the space? Is it an OEM issue? If I get a phone that has a MediaTek, here in North America, I'm importing a lot of devices mm-hmm. to keep up with the global conversation. And that's where I struggle sometimes with the mess of networks and carriers here in the United States supporting the products that you make.
No, I think, I mean, we made a very deliberate decision when we entered 5G that we started with sub-6 only, and we optimized our modems for sub-6. You know, looking back now in history, that was the right decision.
Agreed.
Because millimeter wave really hasn't taken off in any way.
It's really neat on two blocks.
Of course, we've added millimeter wave with the second generation. We have that capability. It's in the flagships. We can deploy it if it's needed. But I think when you look at overall power efficiency, operating power efficiency of our 5G solutions, we feel like we're already there, right? Mm-hmm. When you look even more broadly, you know, we've taken a standardized approach, for example, earlier this year to satellite connectivity and satellite communications, where we said we believe the industry will need to go down a standard-based approach. Mm-hmm. I think when you look at some recent news, that seems to have been the right decision as well, right? So I think I feel like we've already, you know, passed that milestone that your audience member was asking about.
I felt like we were going to be pretty close to that as an answer.
I used to work.
Dashan used to be a modem expert, so he's like,
no further comment.
from my perspective, other than we don't actually make power amplifier, we have reached parity, and actually schedule-wise, we are ahead of them a few years ago.
It's been interesting here in the United States where that actually has had an impact.
When you look at some of the interoperability testing of some of the features like standalone and stuff like that, we had those features available sooner than Qualcomm had in their modem. So we were the lead platform from some of the interoperability testing. So
it's been the major part of the conversation where really this is just the perspective on competition that often we seem to be starved of here in North America. Yeah. As a commentary on competition, my friend Bradley on the Patreon just wanted to throw it out there. How do you compare with Apple's chips? Love them or hate them, they make good chips.
I think we'd all acknowledge Apple does an amazing job with the silicon. Mm-hmm. You know, hats off to them. Class act, right? And of course, then Apple is a unique company in that the ability to optimize hardware, software, and the whole ecosystem is really unique. So they sort of have that special ability, of course. But, you know, I think you can certainly look at Dimensity 9300 and we're sort of, you know, in certain aspects, multi-core, Geekbench, some of the gaming applications, we're sort of bumping up or maybe even exceeding them in some of the spaces, we believe.
Well, I'm not saying that you guys were overly influenced by Apple, but the core configuration on 9300 is looking like it's in a direction more like M silicon than what we've traditionally seen in phones before.
Yeah.
And, you know, not like I'm trying to get the hot scoop, you know, MediaTek confirms that influence came from Apple silicon.
I think JC, our Hasbro wireless business, you know, kind of put it best. I think that decision for us is really based on our understanding of the use cases and the applications, which of course are Android use cases, of course. So I think it's more shaped by that. If it starts to, you know, mirror the leader like Apple, then that's even better.
If there are some general good ideas that we all seemed to arrive at.
But hats off to Apple and what they've achieved with their silicon business.
And remember, so far, that in terms of AI abilities, there is no comparison. Part of the reason is probably not their processor, is because they have very little amount of RAM. But we believe that even if you give them 16 gigabyte of RAM, they still do not have the same AI performance as we do.
Well, doesn't that kind of sort of validate it? It sort of confirms a certain strategy that I think Apple has leaned on. I feel like some of these innovations that we've been talking about, from 5G to this new trend in AI, us on the Droid side, we get to kind of blaze that trail, and eventually they come to a conclusion like it's the right time for them to get into the market. In terms of that AI disparity, very broadly,
Apple did very, very well, but I'm not sure it's intentional or not. That their desktop processor has this unified memory that allow them to do. It just allow them to their people to not have to do any much work, but run some models very slowly.
Right.
but on the mobile side, it's just a different story. So it just, in terms of AI, you do have to have the foresight, and you do have to respond very, very quickly. I think that MediaTek, one of the trends in MediaTek is, even though we're talking about designing SoC for a span of 3 years, we do believe that we have the flexibility to make dramatic changes even later to make sure that the good stuff in AI can run on our latest generation of processes.
Because that's something that I think we lose sight of too from the tech press, is it sounds like you're trying to entertain a conversation where these are devices that are going to be in operation for 3 to 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
Not just next year, we're going to talk about Dimensity 9400, and obviously everyone threw away their old phones and got
the
new stuff.
There's no question, like the lead, like I said earlier, the replacement cycles have been lengthening, right? We can sort of maybe expect Gen AI will trigger some new replacement cycles going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on average, the value on the smartphone business is still increasing. Mm-hmm. People are buying more higher end phones.
We've been moving people up the market.
Sure. And I think that's happening everywhere, like in different paces at different price points. But as a general shift, that's still happening. And therefore, I think people are holding on to devices for that bit longer.
Yeah.
And so, I think that trend will continue. But I think there's also the opportunity that like Gen AI and some of these AI applications could trigger some new replacement demand in the next year or two.
Has there been any pressure on your OEMs, on your customers for increasing support or firmware? We've seen Google now make these grand claims of 7 years of software updates and support. Samsung has tried to push. OnePlus has been very aggressive in that space. I was really happy to see, extended commitment on OnePlus Pad.
Yep.
And obviously that has to be a relationship with your teams to say that this is how long we're going to be willing to support this product out in the field.
Yeah, exactly. And, we have other businesses like our IoT business where we're making even longer commitments to, obviously certain Android versions.
I used to work a bit more of a business beat. And you talk about like warehouse scanners.
Yeah. So
need a 15-year commitment. 10 years.
Yeah. Exactly. So that trend is happening. And of course, that's shaping our software strategy as well.
I'm getting sunset like right in my face. Hey, TK, would you mind seeing if you can get the? I know it'll mess up my lighting, but the other curtain on the side. I know we'll get real dark, and I'll just deal with it.
Now you can see.
Oh my gosh! It's like you guys aren't just like lens blur. As a reviewer, it's really difficult to point people to good resources where I can say, if you want to do more with your phone, you can. And I realize that me as a North American English speaker on YouTube making these tech videos, I'm mostly talking to affluent enough people where the idea of a phone that does phone things, they have a tablet that does tablet things and a laptop that does laptop things, and they're not trying. There's very little experimentation. There's very little interest. Do we believe that AI moving forward over the next couple of years is going to help enable that? Like taking some of the guesswork out of it will guide these people into maybe considering the mobile as even more of a compute platform as opposed to a communications platform.
Well, I think that what you said is exactly true, that the messaging in the press release, we really have some numbers that look great, but it's very actually difficult to translate to your experience. But when you buy, at least when I buy a new phone, I expect it to use it.
Right.
It's very hard for me to say, why am I buying a new phone and keep doing what I was able to do, unless... Right? And that's a problem. With Gen AI, it's very different. But a credit to people like you, right? If you look at the other news sources other than press releases, there are people that do run this test and convince people that if you care about so-and-so, this is a good phone for you. Shall we do more to enable this kind of experience-based benchmarking instead of just raw benchmarking coming out? Well, my personal opinion is, we need to get this up so that people can make better purchases.
Outside of my circles of tech fans, even out to like sort of my near family, there's a lot of exhaustion. Mm-hmm. Like the idea of getting a new phone is actually not a fun, exciting thing. It's a thing they have to deal with their carrier or maybe their financing, and then they have to transfer their information. And then, it's a little bit different in this menu change and I've got to get a new case for it. And by the time they get through all of that, they're using their phone exactly the same way they used their old phone. And they're wondering,
why did I go through all that?
Why did I do all that?
Yeah. So maybe Gen AI is the thing that will change it, right? Because I think it, like Rick, our CEO, was mentioning this morning, like, he's been in the industry a long time, right? And he's got this kind of tingly sense about the capability. It doesn't mean any of us can define exactly, like we were saying, where it's going to go. But it is this very new capability that's mm-hmm. being built in on the cloud side by the big ecosystem players, more and more like with companies like us building capability into the devices. You know, I think that's going to have some very unique use cases that are, frankly, not incremental from what we've had over the last 4 or 5 years, let's say, right?
Well, and to me, it seems like a gap in both sides of the conversation, where the tech media is obviously, we get our clicks with a certain kind of audience. Mm-hmm. And it's been a very difficult conversation for me to say, look at this as a compute platform. The next billion smartphone users are mm-hmm. going to be people who don't have multiple compute devices. Yeah. They're going to live their lives out of this one. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a lot we could learn from helping to like streamline our workflow and maybe minimize some of this tech
device confusion. Yeah,
exactly. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. I know I ran over a little on time.
That's okay.
So I appreciate you taking the time for just kind of sitting down and chatting through this. There have been a lot of questions and some of the trends that we see. There's an excitement. There also have been those concerns mm-hmm. over, but how far will it go, or what might we be able to do?
Can we answer some for you?
Absolutely.
The SGG QA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at MeAudio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
I just got a frog in my throat. I think I'm back. I got the audio there. I really appreciated the time. I was able to sit down with DSU and Dr. Finbar Moynihan with the MediaTek executives for their summit. A lot of questions, and we were kind of chatting out some stuff in the chat, just what the future of this looks like, the incredible resources that are required on our portable computer devices to facilitate some of these experiences. That's all the stuff that we're going to be figuring out over the next year. But there's like a certain style of like corporate interview, right? And you kind of know, oh, well, we're going to try and lead this question back to some of the talking points. But there's something about the MediaTek team where they're at least willing, they're a little more game to kind of follow the premise of the question, like DS coming in to talk about Apple Silicon and being like, well, even if Apple increases all their RAM, they're not going to catch us. So he's like, those little gems for me are kind of the fun insights that you get, the little peeks behind the curtain when we obviously won't get like conclusive answers about all of the relationships that MediaTek facilitates with their partners. So I had a lot of fun putting that together, and I hope people have enjoyed just that little bit of inside baseball. When a new chip comes out for our phones, it's a critical race to assess its capabilities and figure out what you can do with it. And will this be better than the last chip that they put out? But I think when it comes to the focus for 2024 being so heavily invested in generative AI experiences, we're all going to be buying ahead of the curve. You buy a new phone, especially now, like in 2023, you can get the Vivo X100 Pro or the Xiaomi 14 Pro. You're ahead of the AI curve. Those experiences that we need this AI modeling to facilitate haven't been invented or incorporated into the device yet. So, you know, so many techies will sit back on their, you know, their commentary. Oh, I'm not going to say buy this phone for the promise of what it can do in the future. But there's a major chunk of your chip that is waiting for the OEMs and other app developers to start utilizing those components. And we just have to wait and see what that's going to look like. So and the folks saying in the chat, you know, that it was a great interview. I really appreciate you guys and gals and tech fans allowing me that moment to share that, because I was really proud of that conversation playing out the way that it did. And Simon says, Hypno, media tech shill. I'm telling you, what little I could poke around on the Vivo X100, I'm very anxious to see what this year, 2024, is going to bring to high performance solutions. If folks are fans of the people that do like the in-depth game testing, like GeekerOne and Golden Reviewer. Golden Reviewer just put out another assessment on the Snapdragon 8 Gen 3, and it's the problem I have with every single marketing bar graph, bell curve graph, power consumption graph, is they keep saying, compared to last year's chip, it's 30% more efficient. But I don't have a button on the phone to say, use this like a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 and give me 30% better battery life. And Golden Reviewer, I think, on one of his last game tests was like, it's incredible. We saw a 13% improvement to gameplay, but it came at the expense of 26% more power draw. So the actual performance per watt got worse. That ratio of how much stuff can you do for how much battery is in the phone. And that to me is a major concern. I don't think consumers care that their phone got 10% more powerful. They would want the same level of performance, but give me 20%, 30% more battery life. And I think that would be a winning move. But again, in speaking with the MediaTek executives especially, that is not a part of MediaTek's direct relationship with end users. So MediaTek can make this platform, and then the OEM says, well, I want to use this on it. I'm going to populate this. I'm going to really utilize that. And then they want the bigger AnTuTu scores. No one wants to sell the phone that gets the smaller number in Geekbench. But I don't think any of the consumers would care, except for they're going to see these sort of passive, lazy reviews that say, oh, no, if you just use this phone out of the box, it's going to be a smaller Geekbench score, which means it's less powerful than an iPhone and a Galaxy, and you don't want to have a less powerful phone if you're going to spend all that money. And I think we're just in a sort of a spiral with that tech commentary, tech journalism, focusing on things that are completely synthetic scoring metrics for this. So Kappa Cash, it's in a variety of different solutions. Kappa asking, how do they measure those percentage numbers? What you have to do is dig into like the little asterisk, because often you'll see in like the press kit or in the pitch kit that like in playing this game, we saw this performance curve. In running this synthetic benchmark test, we saw this reaction in a controlled setting. MediaTek's performance notes during the keynote. Oh, you know what? I actually can't claim that. I believe MediaTek was saying their numbers were real world, which to me would probably indicate that they were using benchmark scores derived from the X100. But, you know, now that I say that, I can't confirm that. I don't have a slide to say that that's exactly what it is. But there was a lot of commentary that a lot of Qualcomm's numbers during the Qualcomm event and announcement and summit were mostly lab derived. So not a real chip in a phone, but a platform that they could test the chip under optimal conditions. So it's a, it's going to be some heady stuff. I think there's a huge opportunity for MediaTek to look at this chip and then really start working more with manufacturers for tablets. For some reason, we're going to be really anxious about putting this chip in a phone for North America, a flagship grade, premium, expensive phone, when I don't really think that's been a concern since the Dimensity 9000 was better. It would have been a much better chip for us to use than the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. But after using the OnePlus Pad, that tablet is a monster in price to performance. That thing is a champ. And putting that Dimensity 9000 into a tablet, you can run that tablet close to the performance that we see from the Dimensity 9200. So it's almost like you get a generational improvement to that performance by putting a bigger battery and more surface area, get more heat out of the chassis. Tablets could be a really interesting way. Tablets and Chromebooks could be a really interesting way to kind of bring MediaTek into a bit more visibility for North American consumers. So I'll be curious to see how this next year plays out. I don't think we'll get a lot of phones here, but that doesn't mean we can't find other opportunities to kind of shake up the North American side of this conversation. From Bix Plays, unpopular opinion, but we need more competition to Apple, one of the few laptops that get the same performance on battery as they do while plugged in. Where are the energy efficient chips from the rest of the industry? So that's another thing that was asked a lot. There was no official announcement from MediaTek as to a proper desktop competitor against Qualcomm's announcement for the X Elite Snapdragon. I'm just going to call it the Snapdragon X series. So Qualcomm has, on paper, what looks like an incredible competitor against Apple's M3. And if these performance numbers from Qualcomm's test machines are accurate, we could be looking at computers in 2024, laptops in 2024, that offer similar performance to an Intel part for maybe a third to a quarter the power draw off of your laptop battery. So when you maximize what that chip can do, we see very comparable numbers. Intel wins a few fights, Qualcomm wins a few fights, but it's really, really close. It is comparable performance just in synthetic benchmarks. But then we look at the power draw, and where an Intel chip might be drawing 160 watts, and you can't charge the laptop faster than the laptop will drain the battery, the Qualcomm part might be drawing 80 watts. Where an Intel Core i5 might be peaking at like 60-watt power draw, the Qualcomm part is under 30, so like half, you know? So we're seeing these significant power improvements. I'll say, so many tech reviewers will sit there and thumb their nose at things like Windows on ARM. But anytime someone does that, I know for a fact that that's a person who really didn't use Windows on ARM for any kind of daily driver stuff. On this last trip to MediaTek, I did travel. Sorry, you can hear all the snacks that I stole from the MediaTek executive room when we were getting stuff. But I traveled with my Robo Ancala. So this is Windows on ARM. This is the old Snapdragon 8cx Gen 3. I mean, it's old, but it was really launched for this year. It's roughly as powerful as an 11th Gen Core i3. That's not going to melt anyone's... It's not going to rock your socks. It's not going to like melt anyone's brain. It's just a very reasonable, straightforward tier of compute power, a good daily driver kind of setup. But it's packaged in this beautiful shell. This podcast not sponsored by Robo Ancala. It's got a beautiful quad HD OLED, 60 frames per second, so it's not super high refresh, but it's a pleasant viewing experience. The built-in metal kickstand... under the kickstand, you can kind of get to this little pad right here, and you can swap out the SSD, which no other tablet can do, and it runs Windows on ARM. So that means there is some limitation for legacy software, like old school Windows programs, but every new app, every new service, there's a corollary that works directly on Windows on ARM. And we're seeing more support. Like GIMP now has native support for Windows on ARM. A lot of games, you can go directly into playing them from Steam. You just don't have a ton of graphics power to really put out there. The thing that this doesn't work well with is video editing and rendering. you have to do little app video edits. You can't really get into DaVinci Resolve because DaVinci isn't currently supporting ARM SoCs yet, but we hope that's going to change next year with the Qualcomm X. So this is Core i3 powerful, but with like half the power draw of a Core i3. So you get ridiculous runtime, ridiculous battery life. It's got a pen and stylus input. It comes with like this little keyboard. And all of this package together is usually on sale for around $800. Now, is that expensive for a Core i3? Yeah, but it's in Galaxy Tab territory. And this runs a full version of Windows, so you get real Office apps. And you can also install Android apps. And you can also run Linux. So I have Ubuntu, I have Android 13, and I have Windows on ARM, and I don't have to dual boot. It's all in Windows 11. So an Android app pops up in a window, a Linux app pops up in a window, and you can't do that with an $800 Android tablet. And also, I mean, like, the experience for, like, OLED screens and performance and battery life is pretty close. So that's, to me, like, people have been knocking Windows on ARM. The biggest problem with Windows on ARM has been performance to price. No one wants to spend Surface Pro 9 money on a Core i3, a last generation Core i3 part. Totally understand that. But if you compare a Core i3 against an Android tablet, and the prices are pretty close, and you have a full desktop operating system, full Office and document support, better battery life than a Core i3. It's fanless, so it makes no noise. And you can easily do things like pop in another monitor and go dual display with support for up to a 4K display. Some of those things that aren't always a part of our Android tablet experience. This, I'll never go back to an iPad or an Android tablet as like a traveler or a compute resource. This thing has been awesome. And if Qualcomm's estimates are accurate for their low-power version of Snapdragon X, we'll be at the same power draw, but almost tripling the CPU performance of what this thing can do. At 30 watts, that's insane to think that we might be scaling that aggressively year over year. So I feel comfortable recommending this for people who want a good daily driver, email, web browsing, you're mostly using apps, you've got documents and spreadsheets. This thing has been awesome. But if you wait until next year, then we'll hopefully get all the good like graphics capabilities, video editing, and better gaming. That's what we're going to be looking for. That's what's going to be exciting. So that kind of dovetails into the last little piece of this conversation that I want to wrap up for our podcast, and I hope people will just kind of throw out some comments. I'd love to more read what you have to say about this, and I'll just start us off with a few of the things that I've been thankful for. I know it's silly. I hate doing this at Thanksgiving dinner, but I love talking about this with other techies. Like, what tech have you been thankful for in 2023? And part of that was the conversation about the silicon industry. I am really excited about these new conversations we're having about performance per watt, efficiency, better optimization, and something like a little Windows tablet kind of helps manifest that. Like, it's a thing I can point to talk about that says, hey, price to performance and performance per watt, this is a really interesting solution, and I think a lot of people would be interested in this. It's not as scary to take something like this for a test drive. This is overkill for your daily computer home needs. It's overkill for your kids' like schoolwork. And if you were already looking at shopping a Chromebook, then you don't have to worry about like software compatibility, right? This is even better software compatibility than what you'd get out of a similarly spec'd Chromebook in a much nicer shell. That's where I feel like tech reviewers have completely lost the plot. Oh, it's not as good as my gaming laptop, and I can get a gaming laptop for $1,000. And you're like, okay, cool. But you were also just saying you liked Chromebooks, and you were also just saying you like Samsung DeX, and you were also just saying that you like these new Android tablets, and you were also just saying that iPads are cool too. So you're not really comparing oranges to oranges, you're just picking on Windows on ARM because you don't think it's gooder enough for the monies. But that's not really a fair assessment of what's going on. So, silicon conversation, I have been really excited to kind of dig a little bit deeper, to talk about efficiency, to talk about power management. This was such a good year for high performance portable computing. both the Dimensity 9200 and the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2. We don't see Apple making these kind of grand, oh, our phones are so much more powerful than the Androids. That doesn't work anymore. We saw how we've caught feature parity on a lot of these things, with improvements in some areas and some things that we still need to work on in others. I'm very anxious to see the performance conversation ratcheted again for 2024. I hope that these claims of power efficiency do play out. MediaTek's core configuration, that is a very beefy chip. And I worry if an OEM puts it into their phone and they don't properly cool it, this could be MediaTek's version of a Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. We start looking at like 6-watt power draw, 7-watt power draw. We're getting a little close to what made me anxious about how hot phones used to run in 2022. The other thing, and you'll pardon, this is just a little bit broader. Last week on the podcast, I really appreciated y'all letting me kind of take a moment on the show to talk about my cousin Phil, who we recently lost. And I found a whole bunch of photos and videos from previous Christmases and family reunions and weddings, stuff that I thought I'd lost. And it was all on my NAS, but I had a stupid organization system for, these are my family photos and videos. These are the photos and videos that I have used to make a video project. And for some reason, I never moved video project photos and videos back into my family photos and videos. So I recently just put out an email saying like, hey, I found some extra stuff. I'm so sorry I couldn't share this before the memorial. But just the outpouring of family love and support, it meant a lot. I needed to have those conversations and to kind of laugh while crying about some of these great memories with my cousin. And it really drove home for me again. I speak about this stuff in a very sort of high concept or hypothetical kind of way. But another reason why I'm so antagonistic to social media platforms right now, it turns all of our important memories into this race for content. It's content that you're supplying a social media site with when you share a vacation pic of your family, when it's a hug with your cousin, when you're out on the town with your best friend. And then we're sort of trained to let go of it. As soon as the algorithm is done with your content, it's sort of scrapped. There's no relationship. No one is interested in going back through my backlog of Instagram pics. No one is interested in checking out older videos that I might have already covered some of these topics on YouTube. It is a constant pressure to come up with the new novelty, and the social media platform rewards you with likes and shares and engagement, and you can maybe even turn that into a career where you monetize your traffic. None of this stuff with Phil would have been monetized. None of this stuff with Phil would have lived for very long on social media. But I had moments of him in full HD telling stories and getting laughs and sharing a drink with us other cousins and just being goofy Phil. And he gets to live that little bit more in a very sort of Dia de los Muertos style idea of memory. He gets to live on a little bit better, a little bit clearer. We don't lose his voice. I won't forget what he sounded like. I won't forget how his smile would like totally change the whole shape of his face because he just had one of those big, huge smiles. I don't lose that. And now I become even more precious. Like, I got to make sure my wife's phone is backed up and it's going to the NAS. And then we also do a separate cloud storage backup for things like if it's photos of Lex. I don't want to lose any of it because my brain is Swiss cheese right now. I have a terrible memory. So the other tech that I am eternally grateful for is this relationship. Is this system that we can build ourselves, not relying on another company to host this and use it for content and scrape it for AI and monetize your behavior and sell you off to advertisers, what we can make ourselves, where you just go and get a little drive. This is 4 terabytes of storage space right here. You can just kind of pop that into any system you want, and then you tell your phone, hey, when I'm charging you and you're connected over Wi-Fi, I want you to dump all those photos onto this 4 terabytes of storage that I've spent $150 on, and then I have it. and I own it and I can look back on it. And if something happens to me, my family can draw from this and remember and look back on this stuff. If something happens to another one of my family members, heaven forbid, I have it. It's mine. And I can share it and I can disseminate and I can like bring people in and we can share those experiences, but I am not beholden to another company's idea of popularity for whether or not my memories live on. So that to me was the one, it was the toughest part of this year, getting into the holidays, getting to visit with family, and it's such a precious opportunity, and yet at the same time, it's for just one of the most awful reasons that we could come together, but also like we needed to do that and we needed to be there for each other. That to me, our cameras on our phones are incredible. Why would we ever treat our family memories as being such disposable fodder for a billionaire to make more money off of us? I'm getting increasingly antagonistic. Like, I'm not interested in participating. I'm not interested in cheapening my memories. I'm like even less inclined to share photos of Lex public. They're mine. And I don't want like a handful of likes to determine whether or not my daughter is popular enough for social media to be on my channel. Like, that's just so disgusting to me in this current flavor of whatever the web version is, web 2.3, web 4, whatever we're doing. Ooh, hey, I like that. So, okay, just to wrap up some of these comments here, and if anyone here has a few others that you'd like to throw in, what tech you were thankful for, I don't mind spending a couple extra minutes here. Simon says, Hypno says, the Robo Ancala is 521 British pounds at the moment. Wished I'd known that before splurging. I don't know what it is here. Let's see, Robo Ancala. It was on sale over the summer. Like, it was like $6.99. It was like a crazy deal. It would help if I put in the website correctly. so let's see. Oh, it's also on Amazon now too. So I should probably update my links on my, review. Oh boy. All right. I will absolutely update these links. This podcast is not brought to you by Robo Ancala, but if you wanted a decently spec'd little Core i3 style convertible tablet, hold on, let me pull this up. I normally don't do the whole shopping thing. The laptop bundle, which is the tablet and a Bluetooth keyboard. So it connects like a keyboard blade, like a Surface, but it can also detach and be used as a Bluetooth keyboard, is $639.99. This Snapdragon 8cx Gen 3 is roughly as powerful as an 11th gen Core i3, and it's more powerful than, say, an 8 gen 1. In a lot of the tasks that you would use it with, it's a better performing tablet than, like, last year's Galaxy Tab S, what is it, Galaxy Tab S8 Ultra, whatever device you want to compare it against. So for $640, that's actually pretty good. And it's a full version of Windows. You can install Linux on it. You can install Android apps on it. You will not find a more flexible overall tablet than that Robo Ancala. Lampros is saying, I am looking at your older videos. Well, thank you, Lampros. That's very nice. I know, like, we were on the Discord, and someone was like, hey, I just went to your channel page, and it's, like, videos from 6 years ago. And I'm like, of course, YouTube is not promoting anything that I've done recently. Thanks, YouTube. You're awesome. But thank you for checking out some of my older videos. Let's see. Bix Plays. I spent like $800 on my Galaxy Tab S4 when I got it, and I love it. Being able to run Windows and Linux apps on something that same price sounds great. It is great. And again, I said, you know, how GIMP now has built-in support for Windows on ARM? So much faster on Linux. So if you installed the Linux version of GIMP versus the Windows version of GIMP, it's night and day. So it works really well on the Windows version, but then you just try the Linux version, it's like, pop, and it's just up and running. It is so nice. And again, it's like, if you like to tinker a little bit, this is an incredible platform to play around with some of that stuff. Lampraz is saying, I want a NAS too. I think this is a really good time to look at turning a cheap little mini PC into a baby file server. You can get an Alder Lake 12th gen Celeron style fully built mini PC with like 16 gigs of RAM and 512 gigs of storage with Windows 11 pre-installed. I want to say that's like a $200 computer right now. And then you just pop on a really big drive. And you, I mean, it's not a complete and total like RAID array data protected NAS, but you could make something really beefy for not a lot of money right now. Simon says it. No, damn, I'm raging now. LOL. I really liked this Robo Ancala. It really has been a brutal tablet. Brian Billing, I am most thankful for my Nikon Z6II and Z50. Got them a little over a year ago. Going mirrorless has been awesome. Helped me win AP Photographer of the Year in my state. So if you haven't seen, Bryant has shared some photography. And Bryant, you're on Flickr too, right? Phenomenal photographer. And I've seen some of his like sports shots and an incredible eye for capturing action. So I totally get. Like, Nikon's mirrorless strategy is pretty strong right now. Michael Corcoran, I'm thankful for my LG V60 and my Pixel 4a. Still the two phones I used the most, and still with headphone jacks. I plan on being thankful for them in a year if they're still working. From Steve Pogue, again, on the Robo Ancala. The full bundle, tablet plus keyboard plus laptop stand plus screen protector plus stylus is just under $700 right now. That's crazy pants. I'm telling you, the Robo Ancala rocked my shot, rocked my socks. DTNL. Wait, Juan, you're telling me Sphero 2.0 review, apps driving and swimming with orbotic spherical robot is not your latest video? I have been bamboozled. Bamboozled, I tell you. I'm really proud of that video specifically. I'm so glad you brought that one up. I was working on set for the Sphero 2.0 rollout. They had Grant Imahara, Veronica Belmont. I don't know if Alex was there. But there was like a whole bunch of like web celebrities at the time. This is an old video. And I go up to the person, like, I'm just running sound. I'm trying to stay out of the way, but I'm talking to one of the PR reps. He's basically like a talent agent for all of these web celebrities. Just like, yeah, I've done some work on this. I'm doing some work over here. I might be joining the team over a pocket now. I'd love to chat if there's an opportunity. And he kind of looks at me and he's like, let me know when you've got more followers. And like walks away from me. Like, I am not going to talk to this guy at all. And I get it. That's fair. He's there to represent his clients. Someone's pitching him. That's not how things are done. But it wasn't really like me trying to step on him. I was just trying to have a conversation to see if there was a way we could follow up and I could chat. I could put a pitch deck together. I worked in casting. So anyway, they put out all these videos. You know, oh, I'm Grant Imahara and this is a Sphero and you are super cool. The folks at Sphero talked to me while I was setting stuff up. And you're like, hey, do you want to take one home? And I was like, yeah, I do. And I nerded out hard. I mean, like, I was just bouncing. I still have that Sphero. It doesn't work anymore. The battery died. It's still on my bookshelf, just on that lower shelf back there. And so I put out my crappy review video. It is shot like at a studio that I used to work at that had nasty 70s era shag carpeting. I threw it in like the backyard pool that I had that we had at this terrible apartment complex. And that video, that Sphero video, did more traffic than all of the web celebrity videos combined. I was like, yeah, take that, stupid talent agent for web people who doesn't even exist anymore. You suck. I'm not bitter at all, nor am I vindictive. Oh, Steve Pogue, it's $691.96. We are on active watch for the Robo Ancala. Again, I want to point out, it will not do video editing style tasks very well. Your gaming will at best be arcadey with like 720p resolution. But the second you do anything else, document, photo editing, stuff like that, it is a respectfully powerful machine that uses way less power than a comparably spec'd Intel machine would do. Nick Gay, bro, I'm still thankful for my Galaxy S21 Plus and Juan's photo book. Oh, thanks, Nick. Take Better Photos. I've forgotten the name of my book. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs, now on Amazon Kindle. Juan's photo book has me shooting better photos than a Pixel 7 in any iPhone I compete with. I'm glad to hear that. Brian Billing saying, not only on Flickr, but he's also on Mastodon too, because that Mastodon is where all the fun techies hang out now. So you should definitely be on Mastodon. I mean, if you want to be like a crappy techie, you can stick with some other social media service, but Mastodon is the preferable social media service for people with taste. Simon says, Hypno, Ace PC still hasn't shipped the Wizbox G. I'd have gotten the Robo and Kala if I'd known. Now, the Wizbox G is a beast of a machine, though. So if you really need the horsepower, the compute power, the better GPU, I'd stick with the Wizbox. It's not me, obviously, it's not going to be portable, but that thing is a champ. I am still very impressed with that performance to the price to performance on that. But if you want the portability and the low power draw and the longevity out in the field, then maybe see if you could get that Robo and Kala. Oh, baseball super. I watch that spherical robot video weekly. You're the one that's keeping it relevant in YouTube search. I love it. Simon says, Hypno, I'm thankful for family and my Honor Magic 5 Pro. And that is a wonderful combination because I love sitting with my family. I have a terrible memory for the events that we do with my family, and I am always grateful for having a great camera in my pocket. And of course, with an Honor Magic, you have a phenomenal camera in your pocket. Nick Gay, I would not. Nick asks, would you upgrade a Surface Pro 7 to the Robo and Kala? Genuinely, I wouldn't. Because you're sort of a lateral move in terms of compute power with a little less functionality for some of the heavier lifting compute tasks that would utilize the GPU. But I would be critically anxious to see what happens with Qualcomm X, Snapdragon X next year. That, I think, would be a more substantial upgrade. The Surface Pro 7 is going to kind of do all the same things. The only reason why I would switch Surface Pro 7 to a Robo and Kala is if you were okay taking the hit on GPU compute power, but desperately needed more longevity and battery life. And then it's a maybe, but to me, that's too much of a lateral move to like spend the money. And then maybe next year we might see a Robo and Kala 2 with Snapdragon X built in. Ooh, Aditya, I like this one. We can take it to some audio. I am grateful for the wide bore ear tips I purchased recently. They really opened up the sound on my Les Schauer D13 IEMs. I don't know how you pronounce that name. And it's almost like using a whole new pair of IEMs. Oh, and I'm grateful for my laptop and my phone, both of which helped me prepare for my exams, helping me graduate from university. And I think that might be where we kind of start wrapping this up. I need everyone to congratulate Aditya Anil. He done graduated, and that is amazing, and he deserves all the pats on the back. So Steve Pogue, I'm curious, if the Robo and Kala can run Android, can you find the Android versions of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Dead Cells and run those versions better than the Steam versions? Unfortunately, no. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles requires the Netflix sort of communication, and that gets a little wonky, and I haven't tried with Dead Cells. I might be able to get Dead Cells working, but I didn't try. I ran Dead Cells directly off of Steam, and that worked great, so I didn't really think to try and source an APK to see if that would run better. That's a fun one. I should experiment with that. I'll tinker. If I can get a good answer for you, I'll come back. I'll let you know. Oh, Nick Gay, battery life is my biggest pain point, but thanks. I mean, again, it's on a good sale. It's really good hardware. It's a solid maybe, but I think you'll find that, like, okay, it's doing tasks kind of the same. I don't know. I don't want to tell you no, but also I'm real anxious when someone's like, this one little feature is kind of a rock in my shoe, but it means swapping out a whole other functional computer. I'm I'm leaning towards maybe just ride it out if you can. If you absolutely need to buy a computer, then I'm feeling pretty good. This is where you're going to step off that ride. But if you can wait, always wait. It's always going to be better. So, yay! Congrats to Aditya from Nick and Bix and Bryant. All right, folks, we're going to start bringing this in. We're going to land this plane. Next week might get a little weird just because we're traveling and we're visiting family. If I can pull off a stream next week, it's going to be our pajama podcast. So it's going to be super low key. But really, more than anything else, for folks here in North America, it's Thanksgiving. This is my favorite holiday of the year. This is about coming together as family and breaking bread and spending time and not about buying stuff. And I know Black Friday is the time of the year where we're supposed to buy stuff for Christmas, but I'm always anxious that the idea of Thanksgiving gets sort of lost in the shuffle. My daughter has been working diligently to make Thanksgiving decorations because they don't sell them like they used to. They used to sell Thanksgiving decorations at grocery stores when I was a kid, not like they do today. Like Halloween was over weeks before we got to Halloween, and then Christmas stuff was already in short supply as Halloween was coming on the calendar. And I feel like that kind of ratcheted consumerism is a frustrating situation. Like, my daughter doesn't get to have fun with this stuff like she should because retail outlets are in such a blind sprint to force us into, or sort of neg us into buying more stuff. Next week is Thanksgiving. If you are amenable to celebrating Thanksgiving, I hope you get to spend time with people who care about you. I hope you get to eat some awesome food. If you don't celebrate Thanksgiving, I would say use this as any opportunity to catch up with family and friends. Like, be Thanksgiving adjacent and invest some time into those family relationships and friendships. And I feel there's any good reason to kind of have a party or to check in, now is a good time of year to do it. Also, just because the end of the year, we put so much stress on ourselves to finish up the year. We put so much pressure on ourselves to wrap things up. And it's never a conclusion. You know, like, we haven't even finished November and I'm already fielding content that I'll be producing in February and March. There's no end. There's no new beginning. It is a constant process. And we look at the calendar and we act like, oh, well, this is when this year ends and the new year begins. Now I have a new year's resolution and everything's fresh and new. But that's not really how all this stuff works. And it's important that we check in on those people that we care about. Some people get lost in that shuffle and some people really start hurting for that. And in a stressful time of year, I'm going through a stressful time of year. I'm sure all of you are going through a stressful time of year. Let's not lose sight of what this time of year should represent. And if you can look out for someone, then I think you're doing the good work. So as always, you probably aren't properly thanked for being good tech neighbors and good tech citizens, but I thank you for participating and for being a part of solutions, not just contributing to other parts of problems. So I want you to have a fantastic week. I want you to do awesome. I want you to be awesome. I want you to eat some awesome food, regardless of where you are. Just do me a favor. This coming Thursday, even if you're not celebrating Thanksgiving, go get your favorite eats. I think it'll do you good. I'll catch you back here maybe next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show as I go high-pitched in question mark up inflection. I hope that'll happen. It just depends on how our travel works out. And I'll catch you back in a future episode of the podcast. Be safe. Take care. I love you all. I'll see you again.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take better photos. Smartphone photography for noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.